Good morning. I'd like to call this work session meeting to order March 19, 2019 at 9:08 a.m. Before we proceed with our business, Carter has a statement he needs to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, a public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay to proceed? Okay. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from the previous work session held January 23, 2019. Those minutes have been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Commissioner Bell?
Second.
Second. Latimer, all in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Thank you. All right. Update item, work session item number one, our update on the progress in implementing the Land and Water Resources Conservation Program. Just do it from your
seat. Okay. No, that's great, Chairman. Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith. I am going to have to get this little slide over here so I can change slides. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As is customary and by law, just a quick update on our internal affairs team. John and his team continue to do a very good job. John has increasingly placed an emphasis on real proactive outreach to our employees just to make sure that everybody is acutely aware of the policies and procedures governing the agency and really has made that a priority in terms of new forms of outreach, which I appreciate. Also, John continues to invest in the training for our team and making sure that they're afforded the best opportunities for the skill sets that they need. And so just want to compliment him in that regard. Any questions that y'all have for John on anything related to internal affairs, just please talk directly with him. Second item, let's see here. Here we go. A couple of not new faces because they've been with us for a while. Is John Solofsky here today? John, you out there in the crowd? There he is in the back hiding. John, John recently got promoted our deputy director of wildlife, perched in the back row, which is a habitual seating place for all parks and wildlife employees whenever I'm speaking. So John has taken to that nicely. John, before getting promoted to the deputy director in wildlife, was our district director in the post oak. And East Texas did a terrific job over there for 3 or 4 years. Prior to that, he was a wildlife biologist in Kansas with their Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism, oversaw all of their public lands in a bunch of the state. And so he's going to give a great perspective here for the field in working with Clayton and his team, and we're excited about his leadership. So, John, congratulations on your promotion. We're excited about that. Look forward to working with you in this capacity. Similarly, on the state park side, Justin Rhodes. I thought I saw Justin earlier. Justin, you're there, not in the back row. Justin has been promoted to our deputy director inside state parks. I think y'all have met Justin before as well. He literally grew up in the state park system. His dad was a state parks employee for us there at where, Purtis Creek? Mission Tejas, yeah. And Justin has also worked his way up through the system. He was a superintendent at Martin Dyes in Purtis Creek, and more recently he's been our regional director on the coast out of Houston. And just like John, he's done a terrific job, and we're awfully excited to have him in Austin bringing that field perspective in terms of supporting Rodney and the state parks team. So, Justin, congratulations. I'm real excited about your position here. So, y'all will be seeing a lot more of John and Justin, and just wanted to make sure y'all had a chance to meet them.
Before you go, just want to caution that two people from Kansas is enough.
Well, I can't speak for John, but Justin did grow up in Texas in Rusk. Just to be sure about that, John, if you need to defend your honor, do it now or forever hold your peace.
No more Jayhawks.
No more Jayhawks. Duly noted, Chairman. So we got it. All right. We've talked a lot with the commission about red snapper related issues over the years, and just want to give a quick update on where we stand in the second year of the exempted fishing permit that we have. Remember, that's the agreement that the Gulf states or the snapper states have with the National Marine Fisheries Service, which give the state fisheries governing bodies the ability to set the seasons for recreational angling. So again, this doesn't cover the charter for hire related industry or the commercial sector. It just covers the private rec side of things. Last year, Robin, we had, 82 days? Is that 70? 82, Lance, is that right? Last year we had 82 days, which is the most days of recreational red snapper fishing we have had since probably 2010. Is that right, Lance? Yeah. Obviously, that was very well received by our recreational sector. This year, under that exempted fishing permit, and this is the final year of that, by the way, our total allowable catch was bumped up a little bit, and so our coastal fisheries team has estimated that we could have potentially even more days, again, assuming we don't exceed that cap. We've got to stay within it. And so our coastal fisheries team modeled five different options for recreational anglers, looking at a combination of different start and stop dates, anything from starting sometime in the spring and having some opportunities there, coupled with the traditional summer season, looking at a start around Memorial Day, and then going for 95 days. And then what ultimately was the preference for our red snapper fishermen was starting on that traditional June 1st day and then going for 97 consecutive days. And again, this is for fishing in federal waters. The Texas seas are open 365 days a year, so I want to make sure that's clear. We're just talking about federal waters here. So in consultation with the chairman, we decided to go with this traditional June opening and are letting folks know that they may have as many as 97 days of fishing. But again, that's going to be governed by the total allowable catch. Our fisheries biologists will be monitoring that very carefully to make sure that we don't exceed that. So we'll be obviously getting that word out post-haste and wanted to make sure that the commission was aware of that. Chairman.
As you noted, this is the final year of the experimental
fishing permit.
Mm-hmm. Fishing permit. So should we have a briefing from Lance and Robin at the May meeting on what to potentially expect for next year, just so this commission can
sure.
be thinking about it as we, and it'll be here before you know it in those. I'd suggest that we have a short briefing on this at the May meeting so that everybody here can understand where you think the NIMS currently is and where we could go. And just to be clear, as Carter said, that the number of days is an estimate that's based on the total allowable catch that they permit us to take. So
Could be less than that.
Could be less than that, but we're a lot better off than we were two or three years ago, no question about it. But we still need to continue to press for state control of the fishing. We do a good job with it. We're protective of it, and it's continued to grow. But it's important to resist any efforts to further privatize this fishing component. So. In my judgment, anyway.
Is 97 the max, regardless of the catch?
97 is the max. Yeah, that. I guess it could be extended, Robin, depending on the catch. That is a possibility. You're right. It could extend, but that's what we're estimating is 97 days to give folks some kind of a ceiling to shoot for. Yeah. But that would take them from June 1st, obviously, all the way through Labor Day. And so we cover the lion's share of the time.
Either way, up or down.
That's right.
Based
yeah.
on the quota.
Just can't exceed the catch.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, like the idea of the May briefing, and Robin and Lance will plan on coming back to y'all in May with a subsequent briefing on where we think things are headed next, if that works.
Great.
Okay? Good. Next thing I want to cover, and I see Josh and Darcy Bontempo behind him, is just this is the 20th anniversary of our big game marketing effort. Our communications and marketing team has done a terrific job with helping to promote the big time Texas hunts. You know, that's the chance that hunters can purchase to try to get an opportunity to, you know, hunt, have some extraordinary hunts for, you know, whitetail and mule deer and pronghorn antelope and other big game. This 20th anniversary is set with a lot of milestones, as you can see here, the most entries, the highest amount of gross and net revenue. The return on investment has been terrific, and Darcy and her team have just done a phenomenal job of really doing some very targeted niche marketing and reaching out to the demographics most likely to buy those chances. And ultimately, what's most important about it is generating funds to help support our big game management in the state. So investing in conservation, habitat, research and development, working on restocking when we need that. And as you can see in the 20-year history, they've helped generate over $9 million to help support our big game program. Which again has just been great, and I want to applaud them. Also, with this 20th year milestone, Josh and Darcy and the team are rolling out a new license plate, and you can see that the bighorn sheep, and they went out and asked hunters in an online survey to let us know their preferences in choosing between a license plate that would have a pronghorn antelope or a bighorn sheep, and those that participated voted on the bighorn sheep, and there's the mock-up, and that'll be rolled out. And so for $30, if somebody wants to support the big game program, they can purchase that license plate with that majestic bighorn sheep on it, and $22 of that will ultimately be rolled back in to help habitat conservation and restoration for big game and the great work that Mitch and his team do. So we're excited about that and want to compliment our marketing team, Josh, for all that great work. So well done. Also, our communications team, we've got a new podcast that we want to tell you about, and this is a terrific compliment to the award-winning radio program that Cecilia Nasty from our communications team produces and narrates. And if you haven't heard that, it's on about 80 stations around the state, and it's a wonderful way, to help tell the rich and bountiful stories of our state and our lands and waters and fish and wildlife and parks. She does a great job, but she decided to produce this new podcast called Under the Texas Sky, and obviously the podcast will be available for anybody, anytime. It's targeted at a younger demographic, and clearly we've talked to the commission a lot about making sure that we're doing everything on the communications and marketing side to help bring in new users, introduce non-traditional users, and we think this podcast is going to be a great way to help reach those folks. And so, Josh, want to compliment you and Cecilia for this innovation and excited about seeing where this goes and look forward to hearing about that over the next year. I want to give a bit of an update on where we stand with Fairfield Lake State Park and our lease agreement with Vistra Energy, and I think Bob has notified the commission about this development. Since 1971, we have had a lease agreement on what essentially has been a power plant lake, a coal mine lake, the Big Brown Mine. Some of you may be familiar with that over near the community of Fairfield. We had a lease agreement with TXU and then Luminet, and then Vistra Energy is now the owner of that facility. Back in 2018, the company made what was obviously a very difficult decision to close that mine there at Fairfield. That was a big economic decision, as you can imagine, and had pretty significant consequences, obviously, for the community. It also had consequences for us in that we had a 10-year lease that expires in October 1st of 2020, and consistent with that lease, the company was required to tell us if there was some chance that they might not be renewing the lease, and there was a 2-year obligation to do so. And so, consistent with the terms of the lease agreement, the company informed us that they may not be renewing that lease. They have put that property up for sale, including the acreage that's covered by Fairfield Lake State Park, which is, and I'm looking at Justin for confirmation, roughly 1,800 acres there around the lake, very popular from a fishing and camping perspective. We get roughly 70,000 visitors a year that come there. So it's a big deal for the community. I will say the Vistra employees that have been tasked to communicate this difficult message with Parks and Wildlife have tried to tell us everything they can. They've been as forthright as they can be. Obviously, these decisions are being made higher up in their in the Vistra headquarters. We know that they have gotten bids from interested buyers to purchase the property. We know that they have conveyed to those prospective purchasers our desire to see the state park lease continue, again, provided that the lake is still going to be there and we're going to be able to operate it. And so we know that's been conveyed. We just don't know the status of the sale. And but I did want to let you know that that issue is out there, and want to be prepared to come back and relay to the commission whatever decision we get from them and their successor interest there. So wanted to bring that to your attention. Bob, did I miss anything in that transmittal?
No, that's
good. Okay. Any questions on that, Chairman?
Well, it says on this third bullet point, Luminant has notified. Should that have been Vistra?
I think that should have been Vistra. Yeah, Luminant is a subsidiary
no longer,
of Vistra.
Oh, it is?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's my understanding, is that Luminant is a subsidiary of Vistra. Is that your understanding, Bob? Okay. It's
irrespective. Yeah. The owner is
Vistra.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Any other questions on that? Chairman, one of the things that I don't think we've done as good a job coming back to the commission on is just quickly updating you on the status of land acquisitions that the commission has given us authorization to proceed on. And at Ted and Brent's suggestion, we thought it would be helpful if periodically we come back, maybe at the end of the year, and just kind of let you know the status of where things stand with respect to specific land acquisitions. And so just real quickly, over the last year, our land conservation team has closed six purchases authorized by the commission at various times, covering a little over 16,500 acres. Now, the big one there is Powderhorn, and we'll talk about that. But you can see the diversity of these, everything from the 23-acre tract that we acquired at San Jacinto Battleground at a very significant bargain sale, very culturally significant there. The Hooping Crane Habitat over near Goose Island State Park that we acquired with the assistance of the Nature Conservancy with funding from the Deepwater Horizon. Some important inholdings at Bastrop State Park and over on Follett's Island with the help for the Trust for Public Land. Again, two important places that we're concerned about. And, of course, the biggest one was this roughly 15,000 acres that we transferred from the Parks and Wildlife Foundation over to Parks and Wildlife and our Wildlife Division for our newest wildlife management area, the Powderhorn Wildlife Management Area. And so now Len Palaszczuk and his team in South Texas on the coast are tasked with managing that acreage. We're awfully excited to see that come into the inventory. Been a lot of work on habitat restoration. We've had some great youth hunts out there with the Texas Wildlife Association. We've had a number of public hunts this year that were eminently popular for hunters wanting to hunt whitetail deer and axis, feral hogs and sambar deer. The habitat is just extraordinary, and we're really excited about this being the newest part of our WMA system. So I wanted to let you know that that has been formalized. There is still acreage kept in reserve by the Parks and Wildlife Foundation that ultimately we hope and plan to transfer over to the agency to manage as the state park part of this, but that will come in the future. But I did want to let you know about the balance of it having been transferred in October of 18. A couple of other tracts that y'all are familiar with, the five-acre donation next to Balmoray State Park, just a critical parcel to help with our operations and management and buffer of that park. And, of course, a land exchange that the commission worked on diligently recently, the exchange of a little over 120 acres for that 1,280-acre tract there at the J.D. Murphy that the Conservation Fund helped so well with. And so all of those tracts have closed, and I wanted to make sure, Chairman, that you and the commission were aware of those developments. Any questions about any of those? Anything? Okay, good. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to do just kind of a quick legislative update on where things stand. And obviously, we're midway, which means things are really just getting going in earnest. Also, it's obviously ever-evolving. And so until it's over, let's not count our chickens before they hatch. So I'm going to simply just let you know where things stand to date in general without going into a lot of detail. But let me cover a couple of things, both on the financial side and the programmatic side. I don't want to spend a lot of time on budget numbers that we've already gone over with the commission and which, again, are very fluid and in play. I'll just simply remind the commission that we started in a good place with respect to the base budgets in the House and Senate. We felt really good about the starting points in terms of things like the appropriation of all of the sporting goods sales tax in the Senate and the appropriation of critical funds for capital construction and repair. We also felt really good in both chambers about adjustments to the base that the House and Senate proposed to address priority needs for us that totaled collectively upwards of $28 million. And those are critical needs that we were able to handle internally just by getting the House and Senate's proposed concurrence with us being able to move around some priorities in the budget. So things like plugging the hole from a deficit budgeting perspective in state parks, getting our infrastructure team off of project paid funding and providing a secure funding stream for them. Same thing with our TV show in communications, helping to stabilize that. Making sure that we had funding available to deal with our office space issue down at Corpus Christi, funds to help us with some staff compensation goals, which, as y'all know, are longstanding. So a number of critical adjustments that the legislature started with in the base budget, Chairman, that we feel really good about. So where do we stand today? These were our eight exceptional items. These were the items that we asked for. In addition to what was in our base budget, again, all of this is in play. Neither the House nor the Senate have passed a formal budget yet, and they certainly haven't gone to conference committee. And so, again, everything very, very fluid here. So, again, I'm not going to spend any time going through this table per se. What I will tell you is that the Senate has passed a supplemental bill. That purports to cover a lot of the needs that we identified in exceptional item number six, Hurricane Harvey related damages, which y'all know well. In addition, the Senate supplemental bill provided funding for the law enforcement radios that we really need from an interoperability perspective. So we felt good about that. The budget itself this year is initiating on the House side before it comes over to the Senate. So the discussions of our exceptional items in the Senate are still being considered by a subcommittee inside Senate Finance. And again, that's got some time to play out. On the House side, the House Appropriations Committee has passed a proposed budget. They did that yesterday or the day before, along with a supplemental bill. Without going into a lot of detail, Chairman, both the supplemental bill in the House and their proposed budget bill covering the agency looks good, and we're guardedly optimistic about a number of these exceptional items being addressed either in whole or in part. But, again, that's going to have to go to the full House, which we understand it will probably next week for a full vote. Then it'll go over to the Senate. Senate will pass their own budget. Then it'll go to conference, and we'll see where it goes. But I will tell you at this juncture that we spent a lot of time on this issue with your support with members, Allison, Winnie, and David, Mike and his team been very active, as have other members of the team, and we're very hopeful about what the budget will portend for the next biennium. These are some budget riders that are important to us, and again, everything's still in play in both the Senate and the House, but the House Appropriations Committee has adopted several that were priorities for us. Others have been sent to what's called Article 11, which is essentially a parking lot or placeholder for things to be considered either by the full House or in conference committee. But again, you can see a number of these that were already proposed to be adopted by the Appropriations Committee. So those go to the full House as their recommendation. I'll call your attention to the first one that we've talked to y'all a lot about, the ability to move unexpended balances for construction projects from one biennium to the next, and that's a very important fiscal management tool for our infrastructure team as they're dealing with the unique peculiarities of state contracting and purchasing and bidding out construction projects, big and small, all across the state. And so, having a little bit more flexibility to help us manage through that will help. I'll also remind the commission that, assuming the Joint Facilities Oversight Committee is reauthorized by the House and Senate, that Chairman Hancock has very capably overseen, will continue to work very, very closely with that committee on dealing with sometimes our shifting priorities and our fiscal challenges that come up in the course of the biennium. And Chairman, I think you heard him speak to that relationship yesterday in Senate Finance Committee and how well Jessica and her team have done working with he and the committee on making sure that they are aware of things. So we're not looking at this rider as a way to move lots of unexpended money from one biennium to another, but it will help us just from a cash management perspective and, again, dealing with the contracting issues that invariably come up as we bid out these projects. So, again, things are looking positive on this front. Statutorily, got a bunch of bills obviously up, and the committees are moving forward now. The chairman was down at Senate Finance yesterday to hear a testimony on Madam Chair Colcor, Senate Joint Resolution 24 and Senate Bill 26, which deals with the proposed constitutional amendment and appropriation of the sporting goods sales tax to help fund state parks and historic sites. Chairman did a great job representing the department's perspective in that regard, and I'm pleased to report to the commission that Madam Chair Colcor's bill was voted out of Senate Finance 11-0, and so that will then move to the full Senate for consideration, and if the Senate elects to adopt that, it'll then go over to the House for their consideration. And got a lot of co-sponsors for that legislation in the Senate and also on the House.
And I would add to that, I'm sure most of you who are on Governor Patrick's email list saw that this is one of his 30 top priorities for this session. So that, I think, is portends good future for this in Senate.
Yeah, all appendages crossed. So, a couple other bills I'll comment on. The cultivated oyster mariculture, important piece of legislation that Robin and his team, Lance, have been working closely with Texas A&M Corpus, CCA, the City of Corpus, Texas Restaurant Association, and others. If passed, this would give the commission the authority to set rules governing the establishment of oyster mariculture along the coast. Obviously, a big issue. That bill was heard in the House Culture and Recreation and Tourism last week. It was left pending, but I'll probably expect for that bill to get voted out, if not this week, next. But seemed to be a lot of interest in that. Chairman Perry's Breeder Deer ID bill was heard in Senate Water and Rural Affairs yesterday. A lot of testimony surrounding that issue, and had obviously a number of staff there to talk about that, Clayton and Stormy in particular. Today at House CRT, we expect the bill having to do with the oyster harvesting in closed areas to be heard, as well as a sand and gravel related bill as well. So lots of things moving statutorily, Chairman and Commissioners, and obviously we'll continue to keep you updated through David and Allison's good work as things progress. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I would like to note that when you mentioned staff being down at the Capitol yesterday to work with Chairman Perry on the breeder deer identification bill, you were there too until after 7 p.m. Question on HB 4079 on the oyster leases or certificates of location. Mm-hmm. Can somebody remind me of whether that bill proposes to change the statute that would allow a bidder, allow the renewal, sorry, let me restate, that would allow the holder of a certificate of location to continue to have a right of first refusal, but still up the, at the expiration, up the bidding, if you will, to fair market rates?
I'll have to defer to Bob or Robin if they know the answer to that.
For the commission, or for the record, Robin Rikers, Coastal Fisheries Division. Chairman, the bill basically does two things. One is it does do what you said. It basically allows the first right of refusal, but gives the option for the commission. And even now, the commission has an option to increase the fees, but it states that further. It also allows the commission to change the terms of the lease, meaning the length of time of the lease, which right now it's set at 15 years statutorily.
Well, could somebody send me the proposed language on the upping of the rates? Because as I think I've said before, in my view, it's fine to have the holder continue to have a right of first refusal, but the public ought to have a chance to bid at market rate, and the state should receive market value for leases of its property. So I feel like we need to push for that if it's not being done so, and I'm not suggesting it's not. So if somebody could send me that, I'd appreciate it.
We'll get you that language today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, any other questions for me on anything I presented? Okay.
Good?
Good. Yeah. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Carter. All right. Item 2, Mike Jensen, Financial Overview.
Oh, sorry, Mike. Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners. I'm Mike Jensen, Financial Resources Division Director. I have a number of slides. It looks like a lot, but I'm going to go through them fairly quickly because the commission has seen this layout and format repeatedly, with the exception of the two newer commissioners. I wanted to give you a snapshot look of the pattern of state park revenue that typically happens in a 12-month period. This is what the pattern has looked like for a number of years, but we are moving to a new park system. It went live at the end of January. And one of the differences with that system is how we handle reservations. In the old system, you only required payment up front of the first day of a reservation, even if it was multiple days. And reservations could be made for more than 300 days in advance. The new system requires full payment of the reservation as well as the entry fees at the time the reservation is made. And it also have an opportunity, if you're not making a reservation, just day use, you can get a reservation in advance for the heavily visited locations. So that may change what this pattern looks like. It's going to probably take a full fiscal year or two in the new system to see what it's probably going to soften the curve, but the trend will probably be the same. Hopefully, we like to have a trend of growth from year to year. I just wanted you to be aware of those changes. And the reason for those changes, they had a goal of minimizing the burden on the customer when they show up there. If all this stuff is done in advance, they actually can go to their site and enjoy the location without having to stand in line. So they're trying to reduce lines. They're trying to improve queue management. That was the main rationale for it. But you can see that the pattern that we're familiar with, it's really spring break is the biggest month, and the summer are the leading months. So the first 6 months are only 35% of the revenue. The last 6 months are 65% of the revenue. If we look at the current fiscal year for September through January, we're tracking fairly even with the prior fiscal year. Basically, if we compare percentage change, it's 0%. We're about $400 behind, so basically we're even. September was ahead by almost 3%. October was behind by 10%. November was behind by 5%, but December was up 7.5%, and January was up 12%. I don't yet have the data on February. Now, if we compare the prior 4 years for the same period of time, this is what it looks like. We're even again with 18, but we're behind 17, which is the year of record, by about 10%. But you got to remember, these months are the lowest periods of revenue for the department. So if we have a strong spring break, which I hope that we will this month, and a strong summer, hopefully we get ahead or get closer to what that 17 level was. We're ahead of 16 by about 1%, and we're ahead of 15 by 8% for that same period. And this is what it looks like just compared to the prior year. Like I said, we're even at 0%, $16.55 million in each of those years for the same period. And this shows you where the variances are on revenue as well as with visitation. You can see the interest fees are down, but facility use fees are up. And with respect to visitation, total visitation is down by 4%. However, paid visitation is up just under 1%. Moving to the boat revenue, this is what the pattern is for boat revenue. It's even more backloaded than state park revenue. The first 6 months only account for about 30% of the revenue. Last 6 months, about 70% of the revenue. The peak periods are May and the summer, so we're basically starting right now, this month, the peak period for collection of registration fees and boat titling fees. And the importance of that is during a year, registration fees account for probably about two-thirds of this fee revenue stream during the course of a year of $22 to $23 million that comes in. So if we look at each of the months of this current fiscal year, September was ahead 7%, October was behind 4.5%, November was behind 10%, December was about even, January was ahead 9%, and February, I have that data, is actually ahead by 2%. So through January, we're ahead by 1%. And that's what it looks like when you compare the same period with the prior 4 years. It's a relatively flat revenue stream. 18 is and was the best year of record, so we have an opportunity to equal or exceed that. We hope we do. But like I said, the growth slope on this is fairly flat and has been for a number of years. Revenue is up 1%. That accounts to about $52,000, and this gives you the variance of the three categories, sales tax, titles, and registrations. What I'd like to point out for Commissioner Bell and Afflin, since you're relatively new to the commission, the amount that is reflected in this line for sales tax reflects the 5% that is appropriated and available to the department. We actually collected $17.24 million in total sales tax. The other 95%, $16.38 million in 18, and $15.03 million in 19 is retained by the state treasury. So it's a lot of work is done out in the law enforcement offices on this area, developing and generating revenue not only for the department, but for the state of Texas. And you can see we're behind in most of the categories with respect to registrations and titles. But then again, we need to see how we perform this spring and early this summer, because that's really the period, the peak period where these things we'll see hopefully some improvement. License sales, the way it's structured, it's predominantly front-loaded. And in fact, you can see from this slide that the first month really accounts for nearly 40% of the revenue. First 6 months is roughly 75% of the revenue that comes in. And the last 6 months is primarily fishing-related license fees, and it's about 25% of the revenue for the year. Now, if we look at each of these months for this current fiscal year, we can see September was ahead by about 4%. October was behind by about 7%. November was behind by about 7%. But December was up 2%. January was up 4%. And February is actually up about 6.3%. But we're tracking almost even 0.1% better than the prior license year. So when you compare those four-year periods, this is what how it graphs out. Ideally, we want to return to at least the licensure 17 level. I don't know that we're going to achieve that this year, because really, with respect to the hunting, there's not going to be much of an opportunity to improve upon this variance that you see on this slide. There's not much hunting left to do, but we do have great opportunities with fishing. For where we are today compared to the prior year, we're ahead on the fishing licenses, and we hope that trend to continue and to be even better this fiscal year. Now, the last slide I have for you, one of the reasons I present is to get your review of the budget adjustments that were made. At the last meeting, the adjusted budget that was approved was $566.01 million. We have five categories of adjustment for the months of December and January.
We have the first item is $5.12 million. That's operational, non-capital, unexpended balance. Those are monies that were available in the first year of the fiscal year that are now available in this fiscal year, the second fiscal year of the biennium. The second item on there represents federal monies from approximately 16 different federal sources or CFDAs. The top two is 85% wildlife restoration funding and state wildlife grants, and that's an adjustment of total adjustment $7.9 million. The third item on there is appropriated receipts and unexpended balance of $1.47 million. A majority of this comes from donations, and it also includes money from license plates. The fourth item, capital construction UB, is an adjustment of $15.56 million. It's across six different methods of finance to complete the projects that are in queue that the Infrastructure Division manages. Then we have an adjustment to true up actual cost of employee fringe benefits of $130,000. So the total adjustments for those 2 months of December and January is $30.18 million. Our adjusted budget is $596.19 million. And that concludes the materials that I've prepared for presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Members, questions or comments?
I've got one question.
Yes, sir.
On the boat revenue, sales tax?
Yes, sir.
Let me find my slide. Yeah, the you've got 18 versus 19. Sales tax is 862,791. In your variance, is that a positive variance?
Let me look at the details that I have. It should be I may have transposed the wrong column. Let me look for you.
It looks like our titles and registrations are up.
I have the wrong. It's in 2019, the sales tax is 862.2. I have them in the wrong column. I made an error. So the variance is actually correct. Because
18 and 19 are.
Yeah, I put them in the wrong spot. That's an error that I've made because I prepared the slides myself because I don't want anyone else to be responsible. I want to be responsible for my own errors. So that is an error that I made on the slide. But the variance column is correct. And because if you swap those over, because sales tax generally has been growing year to year, primarily due to the efforts of the game wardens out there in the law enforcement office in the field. They've made this an area of concentration probably for the past 4 years. And so if you would look back at the trend of sales tax, you can see that it's definitely has the most growth out of these three categories, primarily due to their efforts.
Anybody else, questions or comments? All right, Mike, thank you very much.
I apologize for the error.
Okay, next is work session item 3, internal audit update, Cindy Hancock. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit, and I'm going to give y'all an audit update. So our fiscal year internal audit plan looks like this to date. With the Texas.gov Reconciliation Advisory Project issued last week, all of our audits and advisory projects have been completed. Very happy to report that. For the fiscal year 19 audit plan, we have 8 projects in progress. The IT audit regarding the Texas Wildlife Information Management System, or TWIMS, is in the reporting stage, and we started planning for another IT audit where we'll try to determine the extent of hardware and software utilized outside of IT division awareness. The grant audit has completed the fieldwork stage, and I'm currently reviewing those working papers. I have 2 auditors conducting the law enforcement fiscal control audits, and we've completed field work at 8 of 12 field sites so far. And we've issued 4 reports with only one office having a finding, and that office took immediate action to correct that error. The fiscal controls of selected wildlife management areas is in the planning phase. And our follow-up audit, which will be ongoing throughout the year, and since my last update to you in January, 7 external audit recommendations have been implemented. Management's currently working to resolve the other 14 external and 17 internal audit findings. And finally, the FEMA and the ADA advisory projects are ongoing. For external audits, we've got quite a few.
Yeah.
Field work for the Comptroller's post-payment audit continues. This audit's been going on for about a year, a little bit over a year. The State Auditor's Office has also begun an audit of the Texas Comptroller's vendor performance tracking system, where they'll be looking at the accuracy of information and user access to the system. Their audit will include the Comptroller's Office, Parks and Wildlife, and the Texas Workforce Commission. Tentatively, this report will be issued sometime in May. We also received notice that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Civil Rights Division will be coming later this year to conduct a compliance audit to the federal civil rights laws. This on-site review occurs every 5 years. Finally, the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Security Division is required to conduct a security audit every 3 years to assess agency compliance with the Criminal Justice Information Security Policy, and this assessment will begin in April. For completed audits, the SAO has completed an audit of information technology job classification series. This audit involved all statewide natural resource agencies. Of the 88 staff reviewed at our agency, 33 needed some kind of adjustment, but all adjustments have been or will be performed by April 1st. So this concludes my short update. Do you have any questions?
Members, any questions or comments? Okay, good report. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Work session item 4, our statewide commercial fishing and oyster fishery proclamation, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Ken Krasowski, followed by Lance Robinson.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Kent Krasowski with the Inland Fisheries Division, and today I'll be reviewing the proposed changes to the freshwater fishing regulations again for the new regulatory year that starts in September, and I'll summarize the public comments on these proposals. First off, on Mill Creek, it's a small lake, as we've told you, near Canton, that has a history of producing large bass. It is currently managed with a 14 to 21 inch slot limit. We are proposing a 16-inch maximum limit, which confines all harvest to bass less than 16 inches, but does allow temporary possession of bass over 24 inches and 13 pounds for submission to the Sherritt Lunker program. Goals are to maximize the catch of larger bass and also allow the harvest of some smaller bass. Next, on Lakewood Lake, which is here in the Austin area, it's being developed as Leander City Park and will include fishing access. The lake will provide another opportunity in the Austin metro area for small lake fishing using kayaks and canoes. For largemouth bass, our proposal is to implement an 18-inch minimum length limit and 3-fish daily bag limit, which we decreased from the 5-fish bag on your direction. The lake has an existing quality bass population, and an 18-inch limit is typically what we use to protect bass populations in these situations from overharvest. Next, on Allen Henry, Alabama bass are considered a different species than spotted bass native to Texas. They are native to the Mobile River drainage in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. We have managed both species there with 5-fish bag that allows a harvest of 2 bass under 18 inches. While abundant, few Alabama bass have exceeded 18 inches. We are proposing to remove Alabama bass from that special 5-fish bag, which means anglers could harvest up to 5 Alabama bass of any length. Increased harvest of abundant Alabama bass may benefit both bass fisheries. On Southeast Texas, we currently have a 12-inch minimum length limit on largemouth bass. It covers those areas indicated there. And the change has been well received in the local area and has local support. We have had some compliance and enforceability issues with waters that border and extend into the non-listed counties. We want to encompass those waters that have bass populations with similar characteristics to eliminate some of those issues. So we are proposing to add a portion of Liberty County south of U.S. Highway 90 and all of Hardin and Newton counties in an effort to improve understanding and enforceability of the 12-inch limit. Tweedleben will continue to be excluded from the 12-inch limit. And to take a look at some of the public comments we received on these, we did mostly receive comments that agreed with these proposals. All these comments were received online except one. The comments in that disagreed or were in support wasn't any real consensus to those. Mostly a lot of people want to keep the same limit or had suggestions on different limits. And particularly on the Southeast Texas, a lot of we had a few comments indicating to go to back to the 14-inch statewide limit, but you know, we think that 12-inch limit is the appropriate limit for that that area. So you will notice that we are not presenting the regulation proposal for Lake Conroe. We are pulling the staff's Lake Conroe recommendation from consideration tomorrow, pending further evaluation. Staff will come back to the commission in the future about the bass regulations on Lake Conroe. So before I move on to Alligator Gar, do you have any questions or comments on these proposals or public input?
Members, any questions or comments so far? Okay, keep going, please.
I can do that. Starting off with the Alligator Gar proposals on the Trinity River, we are proposing a 48-inch maximum length limit. This means that alligator gar over 48 inches could not be, that no alligator gar over 40 inches could be harvested. There would be no change to the statewide bag limit of one. The length limit would be implemented on the Trinity River from the I-30 bridge in Dallas downstream to the I-10 bridge in Chambers County, and this would include the East Fork of the Trinity River as it goes up to the dam at Lake Ray Hubbard. Under this limit, we would see more larger fish in the population, and most of the spawning gate fish would be protected when they reach reproductive age. This limit would still allow some limited harvest. Next, we're proposing to implement a drawing. The drawing would allow persons selected to harvest one alligator gar over 48 inches in length per year from the same stretch of the Trinity River as we described for the 48-inch limit. This limited entry system would allow non-transferable harvest authorization for a set number of alligator gar. Authorizations would be selected and distributed through a random draw of interested applicants. Alligator gar could be harvested by any lawful means, including pole and line and bow fishing. The opportunity for harvest will be valid for one licensed year, September 1 through the following August 31. The mechanics of the drawing would probably necessitate that the authorization would be valid at a date later, such as October 1st. Next, proposing a nighttime ban on bow fishing, a 1/2 hour after sunset and 1/2 hour before sunrise, you would not be allowed to take or possess an alligator gar by means of lawful archery equipment or a crossbow. This prohibition would be in effect statewide. There are concerns about the increased vulnerability and harvest and ease of targeting large alligator gar during night. Prohibiting nighttime bow fishing for alligator gar is an additional measure that could be taken to protect populations from potential over-harvest. And finally, we would require mandatory harvest reporting. A person's harvesting alligator gar would have to report the date, general location, size, and method within 24 hours by website or app, which is similar to the current requirements for Eastern Turkey. Yeah. We are proposing to exempt Falcon Reservoir, which has a 5-fish bag and has a more robust population, and that information is not needed to manage that particular population. Also, harvest reporting statewide would aid in tracking any harvest that is displaced from the Trinity to other areas. Now, to go over some of the very extensive comments we received on these proposals, tried to segregate them out here by the various proposals. We had quite a few comments both for and against, a little bit of differences there. We had some more agree, some more disagree. We did went in there and looked at the methods. We did ask people what method they used, and when they did respond to that, bows, people were using bows, were the majority of those people responding to that. That pole and line was obviously the next, and there were a few others, jug lines and the other. And as I said, These were all people used self-identify those. We did have a few guides in that sample. A lot of considered opinions on both sides, and these are the ones particularly we got off of the online comments. We also had public hearings. We had four public hearings. Conroe, San Antonio, Athens, and Livingston. Most of the people that did show up at those were against the proposals, so did have some emails and phone calls. We did do a Facebook live webinar, got some comments there, all disagreeing mostly in general. And at least on these categories of disagreement, most of them were against most proposals. There was a little bit more agreement on some of the mandatory reporting. We did receive a number of letters, emails from organizations, businesses pertaining to this, and those in agreement, Texas Wildlife Association and Texas Foundation for Conservation supported all the proposals. The Lone Star Chapter of the Sierra Club supported the 48-inch minimum, but they do have some concerns about harvest levels around the rest of the state. And then we had a number of letters and emails from organizations, businesses that disagree with this. Bow Fishing Association America and Lone Star Bowhunters Association disagree with all the proposals. Bass Pro Shops Cabela's were against the nighttime ban and concerns about the 48-inch limiting bow anglers on the Trinity River. Archery Trade Association and Congressional Sportsmen Foundation both supported our efforts to manage and conserve the guard population, but they were both concerned about the nighttime ban. And just as I was, as I've been sitting here, I received another couple comments from organizations or business. Faradine Industries, which is a bow archery manufacturer, was against the nighttime ban. And then also I received a emailed letter from the Texas Legislative Sportsmen's Caucus leadership that was against the nighttime ban that was signed by Representative Lyle Larson. We also went back out to the Freshwater Fisheries Advisory Committee. We did get some responses from them. The majority was in favor of most of the proposals except on the nighttime ban, which was a 50-50 split on that one. And the Coastal Resources Advisory Committee also was in general agreement with the proposals. And just to sort of somewhat try to categorize, get our hands around the comments that we did receive, quite a few comments, specific comments received on that. These are sort of in order of the ones that we heard the most through the process, starting off with the general opposition. Just people didn't like any of the proposals. They didn't think they were needed. They think the gar populations are in good shape with the one fish bag. So that was their sort of a summary of that. Had mentioned a number of them, the lack of, in their minds, supporting data to pursue these changes. We received a number of comments on alternative regulations, various things, use of tags, different size limits, and there were even some people who believe that we should totally reopen the alligator gar to unlimited harvest. They think there's too many out there and they impact game fish. So that covered a lot of area there. A number of the comments, certainly, especially when I'm talking about the ban of night fishing, they feel that target bow anglers and would have an economic impact in local areas where that activity occurs. There's some concern about hooking mortality under catch and release of the pole and line anglers, and then some general comments about the drawing being a little too restrictive for a tagging system or onerous the reporting measures. So with that, that concludes my presentation, and if you have any questions or comments on the alligator gar or the bass, I certainly try to answer those.
The objection to the prohibition on nighttime bow fishing, I wouldn't know if there been any studies. Is it more advantageous to hunt at night? Is it easier to hunt at night?
In certain situations, it can be. For instance, where there's in the Trinity River where the water is very turbid, it's difficult to see the fish during the day in certain times of year. So some people do like to go out at night, take advantage of the nights to do. We don't have any, percentages of harvest, one versus the other, or different. That ability to go at night and people's preferences fishing for night during the day, it varies around the state. In general, boat fishermen like to go out at night, especially during the summer months, a little better environment than being out there during the heat of the day. So.
Okay, I just didn't know if nighttime using lights made it less sporting, for lack of a better word. If the fish, I just don't know any studies or if the fish are attracted to lights or if that somehow makes it.
In this case, the lights aren't used in attracting. It's just so they can see them in the water.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else have questions or comments? Mr. Warren.
In the last commission meeting, there was discussion about other states that have lacked. This specifically around the 48-inch limit that this proposed. Can you refresh my memory? Louisiana in particular, I was kind of startled by that. I think the statement was made that they don't have many large alligator gar anymore.
No, they do have a very good population. Some of that is that they don't have any sort of limits. They do harvest larger fish. And then with the marshy areas in Louisiana, they reproduce there probably more frequently. So their population is probably sort of set up more to produce a lot smaller fish and not produce as many big fish as our, say, a river system like the Trinity River, which has more limited spawning over time. And, those certain year classes will serve to keep that population going, and those big fish are a little more noticeable component of the population. But typically when we deal with Louisiana, their regulations are typically more harvest-oriented than ours are across the board. So we try and look at harvest plus providing some quality, and we have those quality populations here in Texas that we would like to certainly protect.
I have one question, and I have a partial bias just because I'm allergic to fish. I can't eat fish. Mm-hmm. However, I like all those, and I do love to, I love fishing and whatnot. But in regard to the gar population, isn't there a suggested ban? I mean, they're just being hunted really for trophy. They're not being hunted for food.
Well, on the Trinity River, there is Texas Department of State Health Service has issued a consumption advisory against consuming any gar out of the Trinity River. That's correct. It's not a ban. You're not prohibited. Their suggestion is just
eat at your own risk.
Just right.
Okay.
Eat them at your own risk. And there are other parts of the state where there aren't under those consumption advisories that people do harvest them and do eat some of those fish. So.
Okay. Anybody else? I think based on what we've heard, that in authorizing the proposed recommendations for tomorrow's action agenda, I want us to pull the proposed ban on nighttime fishing so that staff can do more study and evaluation of the effects of spotlighting these fish at night and report back later on it. But for now, let's pull that component of the proposed recommendation so we will not be acting on that recommendation or that potential action item tomorrow, with the exception that the nighttime proposed ban would still apply to the Trinity unless you happen to receive one of these draw tags, in which event you could use the tag anytime except during the spawn. So are we clear on that?
Yes, we could. We'll have to go.
So adjust it so that the proposed nighttime ban is not in effect except on the Trinity unless you draw a tag. And again, even the tag would not allow you to take if the executive director closes the fishery in the spawn. Everybody understand on that?
Yes, and we did have, as part of that drawing, we did allow, you know, all legal archery equipment was part of that, so we would
that's correct.
Continue it.
So. But the number of tags would be set by the staff, but I think that we should probably have some further discussion on just how many tags we should authorize, again, with the goal of protecting these large fish in a fishery where consumption is, you'd be foolish to consume it, let's put it that way. Okay.
So, Chairman, just to make sure I'm clear, but in the Trinity, if you are drawn for one of the tags to be able to harvest a fish over 48 inches, you could do that at day or night?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. I got it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. With that modification, I authorize the 2019-20 statewide recreational. Sorry, we got it here from Lance Robinson, because you're finished, right?
Right.
All right, let's hear from Lance before I make the authorization on the full proclamation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Lance Robinson with the Coastal Fisheries Division. I'm here this morning to present to you four proposals that Coastal Fisheries is bringing for consideration for final action. I'm going to run through the proposals fairly quickly, and then we'll summarize the public comments that we've heard through yesterday afternoon. So the Division of Coastal Fisheries is presenting these four proposed regulation changes this morning. They include the expansion of the five fish bag limit for spotted sea trout, making the daily bag limit consistent coast-wide. The proposed regulation also changes that would include the requirement for the use of a non-offset, non-stainless steel circle hooks when fishing for sharks. An increase in the minimum size limit for cobia from 37 inches to 40 inches, and finally, the temporary closure of recently restored oyster reefs. Regarding the spotted sea trout proposal, the department again proposes to expand the five fish daily bag limit coast-wide. Currently, Galveston Bay and Sabine Lake have a 10 fish daily bag limit for spotted sea trout. The department has received requests from both private recreational anglers and fishing guides to consider lowering the daily bag limit to match the rest of the coast. Coastal fisheries data shows that the population of spotted sea trout in these two systems remains stable. Additionally, most anglers fishing in these two systems land five or fewer fish per day. This slide shows the daily bag distribution for private recreational anglers during the 2017 fishing year. Over 91% of the anglers intercepted during these krill surveys retained five or fewer spotted sea trout. Similarly, the bag distribution for guided trips shows a similar pattern, with almost 87% of intercepted anglers keeping five or fewer spotted sea trout per day. The previous two bag distribution slides represented the combined data for both Galveston Bay and Sabine Lake. However, it's been suggested that the current proposal would result in Texas anglers changing their behavior and would begin launching their boats on the Louisiana side of Sabine Lake to take advantage of the more liberal Louisiana regulations for spotted sea trout, which currently includes a 12-inch minimum size limit, 15 fish daily bag limit, with no more than two of those fish being over 25 inches. Department data, however, suggests that this is already occurring. There are two boat ramps on the Louisiana side of Sabine Lake that Parks and Wildlife conducts krill surveys. This slide represents the residency of anglers intercepted during the 2017 fishing year. Approximately 75% of the private recreational anglers and approximately 10% of the guided trip anglers that launched on the Louisiana ramps are Texas residents. However, data collected during these krill surveys from the two Louisiana boat ramps show that the majority of anglers, 82.7%, keep five or fewer fish. We see a similar trend for guided trips that end their trips at the two Louisiana boat ramps on Sabine Lake, with almost three quarters, or about 71% of anglers keeping five or fewer spotted sea trout. To further gauge the opinions of anglers from these two areas and to get a better picture of angler preferences regarding this proposal, last summer the department conducted a mail-out survey to a subset of licensed saltwater anglers living in a 14-county region. Utilizing the 2017 recreational krill survey data, the department looked at fishing trips ending in Galveston Bay and Sabine Lake, where anglers indicated they were either targeting spotted sea trout or that trips actually had trout in the krill. They landed those fish. Analyzing the county of residence for these anglers, we found that over 90% of these anglers resided in 14 counties around the state. Most of those counties, obviously, were around the two water bodies. A random sample of 2,342 private recreational saltwater license holders from these counties were selected and mailed surveys. Additionally, surveys were mailed to all 358 all-water fishing guide license holders within the 14-county area. The survey results for the guides and the non-guides were analyzed separately, and the effective response rate for the survey was 25%. This map shows a kind of a layout of the 14-county areas, and apologize for the size, but the percentages that you see listed in each of those counties represent the percentage of anglers who targeted or retained spotted sea trout from that county, from those surveys. One of the questions in the surveys asked respondents to indicate their support for or against the reduction of the spotted sea trout daily bag limit. Overall results by sector indicate strong support among guides for a reduction in the daily bag limit, with 77% responding that they support or strongly support the proposal. For private recreational anglers, 45.7% indicated they supported or strongly supported a reduction in the bag limit, while a quarter of the anglers opposed or strongly opposed the proposal. 29% of the respondents indicated they were neutral or had no opinion on the particular proposal. When you look at the survey results by bay system, we continue to see strong support among guides who said they primarily fished in the Galveston Bay complex. For non-guides or private recreational fishermen, about 53% indicated they supported or strongly supported the reduction in the daily bag, 26.5% opposing, and then about 20% indicating that they had no opinion. They were neutral on the proposal. However, when you look at and tease out the Sabine Lake information for those anglers who identified that they targeted or that Sabine Lake was their primarily water body in which they fished, although the sample sizes are a little bit lower, there is less support among fishermen in these areas. Of the seven guides who responded to the survey, clearly 57% indicated they were opposed or strongly opposed, while about 43% indicated their support. For non-guides, about 39.5% opposed or strongly opposed the proposal, 34% supporting, and the neutrality or no opinion was amounted to about 26%. So that's all of my trout proposal. I'm going to go through the summaries of our public comments toward the end. I just wanted to move on to the other ones unless somebody has any particular questions at this point.
Anybody have a question at this point or a comment? Okay, keep going.
Okay. The proposal for sharks would require anglers fishing for this species in state waters to use non-offset, non-stainless steel circle hooks. This requirement would not apply when fishing with artificial lures. The National Marine Fisheries Service has adopted these requirements in federal waters to address overfishing of the species and to help with the rebuilding of the Atlantic dusky shark population. The proposal for cobia would increase the minimum size limit from 37 inches to 40 inches total length. The Gulf of Mexico Fishery Management Council recently chose to change the commercial and recreational minimum size limit for Gulf cobia in federal waters to 40 inches. These proposals would make shark and cobia regulations in state waters consistent with federal regulations, which the department believes will reduce confusion and enhance compliance, administration, and enforcement. And finally, the department proposes to temporarily close 5 oyster reefs within 3 bay systems that have recently been restored through culch plantings or will be restored before the summer. These closures will be for 2 years and will allow juvenile oysters to attach to the newly placed substrate and grow to a legal size before being opened for harvest. The sites include 2 areas in Galveston Bay, Pasadena Reef, a little over 56 acres, Pepper Grove Reef, about 12 acres, one reef complex in the Matagorda-Lavaca Bay area, Noble Point of about 30 acres, and then 2 sites in Copano Bay, one that's been called the Sanctuary Reef, which is about 35 acres, and a non-sanctuary reef about 35 and a half acres. Buoys will be installed and maintained on the corners of each of these sites to help identify the closed areas to both commercial and recreational oyster fishermen. Moving to the public comments for all of the proposals, Coastal Fisheries, we received just over 2,700 comments through public hearings, online, and online and email comments. For the 5 fish bag limit, we had about 70% of the respondents total speaking in support of the 5 fish. That included support by the Coastal Resources Advisory Committee as well as the Coastal Conservation Association. We had about a quarter of respondents indicated they were opposed to the 5 fish bag limit, and about 5% having no opinion on the matter. Of the most common opposition listed at the bottom of the screen there, the number one was about 17% or 18% of the respondents indicated that that the decision to lower the bag limit was not science-based or that science didn't support the lowering of the limit. About 5% indicated that they were opposed because they felt like Texas anglers would buy Louisiana license and it would be a loss to the state of Texas. A few more indicated that they just wanted to keep more fish, so they liked the idea of a lot higher bag limit. And then finally, about 3% of the respondents who opposed it indicated that they believed that this only benefited fishing guides.
Lance, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
Quickly. If I'm a Texas resident, I go to Louisiana and buy, I guess, a non-resident fishing license, fish, and I come onto the Texas side of the lake, am I subject to Texas bag limits or Louisiana bag limits?
Yes, sir. And I'll...
Lance, you want to come forward?
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Director. For the record, Les Casterline, Lieutenant Game Warden for the Law Enforcement Division. I believe the question was over how the trout fishermen would be addressed if they had a Louisiana license crossing in and fishing while in the state waters of Texas.
The first question is, if you're fishing on the Texas side of the lake, are you subject to the Texas limit or the Louisiana limit?
If you're actively fishing in state waters of Texas, you're required to adhere to Texas's size and bag limits while actively fishing within our waters.
Regardless of your license. Okay.
So correct.
So,
or where you launched.
Or where you launched. So this, so buying an LA license, Louisiana license, wouldn't game the system if you were fishing in Texas waters, right?
Correct.
Am I saying that right?
yeah. I guess a way to describe that would be if you're fishing in Texas waters and by chance you had actually launched on the Louisiana side, it would be possible that if they obtained their legal limit while fishing in Texas, if they would stop within Louisiana waters on their way back to the boat ramp, you would have that availability for them to increase to the Louisiana side while actually fishing in Louisiana where that limit would be lawful, if they would land that limit in Louisiana.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else, questions or comments? I'd like to – are you finished now?
Yes, sir. Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to suggest that we carve out Sabine Lake for now, down to the Highland, using the Highland Bridge as the dividing line because of the disparity in the regulations. As I understand it, Louisiana is considering whether to lower its limits, but for now, to avoid that disparity, let's just exclude Sabine Lake using High Island Bridge from the proposed reduction and vote on the proposed reduction for everything else. And that way we can continue to work with Louisiana and address ways to have a consistent management of Sabine Lake.
Now, Ralph, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You're saying the High Island Bridge?
That's the bridge that would be the...
You might, hey, Lance, why don't you pull up those maps and show our two options that...
Law enforcement has two options.
Yep.
That's the one I think is most efficacious.
Besides the 87 bridge.
There you go.
Yeah.
There were two options that, in discussions with law enforcement, option one would be the High Island Bridge at State Highway 521 to the left bottom of the screen. The other option would be up the State Highway 87 bridge right up near the Texaco Point, I believe is where that's called. But in discussions with law enforcement, I think the preference would be the State Highway 124 bridge and where it crosses the ICW. But as you'll see in that slide, as the highway kind of intersects, Highway 124 intersects with the Beach Highway of 87, there's basically a 90-degree turn there. We would then propose that you extend that line, that boundary line, out to the 9 nautical mile line following that.
The only issue that I see with going with the High Island Bridge, you know, we've got the issues at Rollover Pass, you know, where that thing's eroding out and everything real bad. But you're getting them closer to Bolivar Peninsula, and I'm not sure that it's not more advantageous to move it a little bit further east and maybe use the other one rather than the High Island Bridge.
So you've got two options. You could move it east over that bridge over on Highway 87 right there at the edge of Sabine Lake. We can make either one of those work. Les, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but from a purely law enforcement perspective and getting angler compliance on this, what's our team's best assessment of where we can best accomplish that?
The most effective location just because of the layout of the area would be the 124 bridge, mainly because by water, with the inland waters, you're looking at just a small section where you would have a clean break in the intercoastal waterway, and then a well-defined landmark on the Gulf side with where the highway actually intersects with the beach. And it's just very clean. If you move further to the east, what you run into is it's not as clean of a break. You'll actually have some of the areas on either side of the channel that are marshlands where you may have folks that are fishing that could wander into either side of that across the line, making it a little bit harder for enforcement, but also might lead to a little bit of confusion on where the public would be when they're actually fishing. Their knowledge of the area may come into effect there as well.
So,
sorry?
Sure, absolutely.
One of the things in the public comments, not that it's correct, but it says their biggest complaint is science doesn't support it. And we have quite a bit of experience in going from 10 to 5. Do we have any data about this public comment, science doesn't support it, going
from
10 to 5?
Yeah, our current fishery independent data for both Galveston Bay and Sabine Lake, when we look at our gillnet samples and recruitment numbers for spotted sea trout, populations in both of those systems remain stable. As we saw in the Lower Laguna Madre, when the change was first implemented down there, we were seeing some declines in the trends in those populations. And similarly, as we moved that line up to FM 457 there in Matagorda, there was also some indications in the data that suggested that there was some declines in those populations. Now, subsequent to those changes, we've seen that population kind of pull back around. And certainly the expectation here, even though we don't see a we see stable populations in those systems, a five fish bag limit, we would expect to see some improvement in the those larger fish. You would have a higher population of those larger animals in that population.
So we have experience in the two systems south of this that it improved the fishery. The difference is you're saying this fishery is more stable than the lower and the middle were when it was initiated.
Yes, sir.
And so this has a 25% oppose and five neutral, 70 support.
Combined over both of the aggregate of all those comments, that's correct, sir.
Okay. Ralph, what if we exclude this and use, just say we use 124 as a divider, so when will we evaluate or readdress the issue about just going ahead and doing the whole coast, picking up Sabine Lake and everything?
I think that's a good question. I think we could come back at any time, but what I would suggest is give this a at least 6 months to a year to see what Louisiana does.
And I know I'm obviously going to get questions if we exclude it right now, because surprisingly the input I've gotten is they support it way more than I ever thought they would.
Well, we can sure leave it in.
If we're going to do this, and that's fine, you know, I can go either way. But if we're going to do this, I think we need to define what we're going to be studying. What is the criteria to go ahead and do all of it into the Louisiana border?
Well, I think what you'd have, if for example, you waited 1 year, you'd have a comparison of what happened at Sabine Lake over that year versus what happened with the rest, assuming the proposed reduction passed. Wouldn't you at least have that?
It's going to take a couple of years to see the change, what change resulted from a reduction in the limit in Galveston Bay.
Yes,
typically,
when we did the middle section, it was about 2 years before they finally figured out how much bigger the fish were and how much it had helped, just like it did in the bottom third.
Yeah,
I think 2 years is about right.
Would you be okay with waiting 2 years?
I think we need to quantify it so that people will understand why we're excluding it, and just say, okay, we want to get more science, we want to get more data. I'd say a minimum of 12 months, but probably we're here when we pass that middle third, and we've seen what happened in 2 years.
I've got a law enforcement question. Well, if we do exclude Sabine Lake, why don't you just make it the mouth of the Sabine River?
I guess I would ask Lance if they've looked into the that as a possibility.
No, we have not looked at the Sabine River. You're talking about on the north side where the Sabine River comes into Sabine Lake?
No, on the south side where it empties into the Gulf.
Yeah, no, we have not explored that one, sir. We reach out to law enforcement.
Leave Sabine Lake and none of this issue.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see. On the as far as carrying the boundary out, leave it at five fish anywhere on the Gulf side all the way up to the mouth of the Sabine. I mean, that certainly is an option if the commission would like to look at that. That's certainly an option.
I think in light of Dick's and Reed's comments, let's sleep on this. We'll let the proposal go forward as presently worded and talk about it.
And look at the Sabine River, but if we exclude Sabine Lake, which I can go either way on that, but I'm leaning towards 2 years and see what the results are, and maybe Louisiana will we be able to exchange information. So,
thank you, Deanie.
As far as Louisiana, I mean, my preference would be to lead in this as an example for conservation, rather than wait to see if they would also come along, and maybe by this commission doing it, Louisiana would look more favorably on it. I mean, so I'm I'm with whatever everyone else feels like the best recommendation would be, wait 2 years and then include Sabine Lake from when you have the data all along the coast. Or,
well, the proposal now would include right. Sabine Lake. And right. so let's, I'm going to authorize that proposal be set for vote tomorrow, and we can think about it overnight whether we want to proceed with it or modify it and exclude Sabine Lake to one of these points, whether it's the mouth of the Sabine or it's option one or option two or some other option, and ask law enforcement and coastal fisheries to discuss if you were to exclude, the commission determines to vote to exclude Sabine Lake, what's the best location to draw the line.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. So
I got just a couple of more. If we go back to that one, the public comments on the other three proposals. Just wanted
I have a question on that, too.
So yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I thought you'd finished it.
I'm sorry. Let's see. I'll go through here. So moving on to the next proposal was the circle hooks when fishing for sharks. About 47%, a little over 47% of the respondents that we heard from were supportive of this proposal, including the Coastal Resources Advisory Committee and the Coastal Conservation Association. Opposition was about 13%, but as you'll see in these following slides, there was a fair amount of commenters that just had no opinion. About 40% indicated their neutrality. Of those who indicated a reason for their opposition, you'll see at the bottom of the screen what the three top reasons for opposition occurred. The number one is that they didn't believe that the change would have make a difference. And that some people express a desire to use hooks for other species, and that this was unfair to land-based fishermen. For the recommendation or proposal to increase the minimum size for cobia, about 49% of the respondents indicated their support. Opposition, about 12% of those that that supplied those comments. Again, about 39% were neutral. Of the respondents who were opposed, the number one reason for their opposition was they suggested that that we wait for the results of the 2019 stock assessment that's currently being done by the National Marine Fisheries Service for this particular species. Others felt like they just wanted to, indicated they wanted to just to keep more individual fish. And then there was a small amount that indicated they preferred that there be some ban on commercial fishing for this species. And then finally, for the temporary closure of the oyster restoration sites, about 72% of those who responded indicated their support for the proposal. About 2% were opposed, and about a quarter of the respondents were neutral. Of those who responded in opposition, the main comment that we heard is that they suggested that the area be kept open for recreational oyster harvest, or that they wanted to clarify that the area was closed only to oystering, which in the second it is. It's only closed to oyster harvesting. As far as the first comment, keeping it open for recreational harvest, the rationale and the reason behind the closure is to allow the oysters that settle and juveniles that grow to grow to a legal size. So even if you left it open for recreational fishermen, there would be no legal oysters there for about 2 years. It takes that long for those oysters to grow to a legal size. So it would be, our proposal would be that it would be closed for both recreational and commercial harvest. That's the end of my presentation and the public comments. Happy to address any questions you may have.
Well, of course, one of the proposals is to require use of non-offset, non-stainless steel hooks for sharks, but I want to ask staff to come back with a report and some guidance on extending that to other pelagic species. I don't see why we wouldn't do that. Consider it, that's what I mean. So if you will, as soon as practicable, come back and make a presentation to the commission on whether or not staff thinks that type of proposed action should be considered for other species.
Be happy to. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Please.
Chairman, as you bring that up, one of the big questions they say is, and it was going to be a law enforcement question, but 6.8% of the people want to use the circle hook. And so for a law enforcement, you're snapper fishing with the circle hook, which most of them are.
Yes, sir.
Because it's effective.
Yes, sir.
And then you catch a shark. How do we deal with how do you deal with that?
So I believe on that one right there, because it's when you run into that, it's going to be looking at the targeting, what species you're going to be targeting. So that in general, your folks that are going to be targeting sharks, a lot of times we'll have a lot of different gear. You know, so I don't know that it will be a huge issue with the catching and the use of snapper fishing, but it could be, and we would use officer discretion on that, as it relates to the take of it, because it's not the targeted issue.
I think that's about a viable point. What does law enforcement do if you're using a circle hook for whatever and you catch a shark? And then along what you brought up, I believe a substantial amount of the people are kind of the problem they have with the circle hooks is the catch and release and just the nature of the shark. A lot of times people just cut the line and release it, and the hook stays in, and it's stainless, and it doesn't deteriorate. Whereas if you're snapper or cobia or whatever, there tends to be a less cut the line. You can handle the fish and take the hook out or not. But that, from a law enforcement, that would be, I'd be curious how you, seems like it could be an issue for you guys.
I believe we would have to enforce that in a way that we would have to look at, was there species that they were targeting? Were they targeting sharks, or were they targeting
now, did
some
I
type
read,
of reef
is
fish?
This federal already?
Yes, sir.
Federal law already?
Yes, sir.
And you're trying to connect the cobia with the federal regulations and the hooks with the federal regulations?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment, because I like what Commissioner Latimer said about, in part, taking the lead on Sabine Lake. And so maybe we, as we're thinking about this tonight, consider that. But also, the balance is if we can align these regulations, and I like the recommendation that we're moving in one place to align with the federal regulations, it creates less confusion for anglers out there, so that if we've got, where possible and where it makes sense, if we've got a uniform set of rules, it's easier for them to comply, and it doesn't seem like we're playing gotcha with anyone. So to right. The extent that we can do that, I think that's a positive thing.
Good point, and I certainly echo Commissioner Latimer's sentiment. And if you haven't had a chance to watch the acceptance speech of Johnny Morris of the Park City's Boone Pickens Award, you should watch it, because one of the things he did, unprompted by Parks and Wildlife, was to call us out and talk about how Texas had been a leader in law, in conservation and resource management, and how it was a leader that other states tried to follow, because we do take a proactive stance on this. So, good point, and we'll move forward with the saltwater recommendation as currently proposed, and give some thought about what to do with Sabine Lake between now and tomorrow. So, unless there are other questions or comments, again, to summarize, the alligator gar recommendation, the proposal to ban nighttime fishing on water bodies other than the Trinity will be withdrawn and not considered tomorrow, so that staff can continue to evaluate the effects of spotlighting for these fish and come back to the commission at a later date with some guidance or recommendations. And then we would permit nighttime fishing for a gar in the Trinity, so long as you drew one of these tags that we're contemplating authorizing. Okay?
One comment. Carter, Louisiana has had a different bag limit in Sabine Lake in Texas.
For some time. I think the bag limit lands in Louisiana.
We have been leaders, and it's going to take more dialogue with Louisiana to encourage them to follow in our footsteps if they choose to do that. So I just point out that they haven't followed so far. So.
And we keep an active dialogue, just so y'all know, with the Louisiana Wildlife and Fisheries Managers. Our coastal and inland teams and wildlife teams are regularly visiting with their counterparts in Louisiana to discuss these shared fisheries or wildlife issues. So just know that is ongoing and a priority and something that's happening pretty regularly.
Thank you. Sorry. Okay. Work session item 5, the 2019-20 statewide hunting and migratory game bird proclamations. Alan Kane.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Alan Kane, Whitetail Deer Program Leader, and this morning I'll be presenting proposed changes to the statewide big game hunting proclamation, which will be seeking adoption of these proposed changes at tomorrow's meeting. The first proposed change is in regards to the Managed Lands Deer Program and refusal for enrollment. Current regulations allow the department to refuse enrollment in the MLD program for participants that have missed reporting deadlines, exceeded harvest recommendations, failed to conduct a required number of habitat management practices, and certain violations of the Parks and Wildlife Code. This proposal would amend the current rules to authorize the department to also be able to refuse enrollment for any tract of land enrolled in MLD in which a deer has been harvested but has not been presented to a mandatory check station for chronic wasting disease testing. Refusal for enrollment would not be automatic, and the proposed change would clarify and rule that the department would be able to take into consideration factors that include whether the applicant has advised a hunter of mandatory check station requirements for CWD testing, whether that applicant has encouraged, advised, or directed a hunter not to present a deer at a mandatory check station, or the number of deer harvested on the MLD property that were not presented at the check station, and any other aggravating or mitigating factors the department deems relevant. To date, we received 124 public comments. 92% agree with the proposed change. 8% disagree. No comments were made by those that were disagreeing with the proposed change. This is also being presented to the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, and they supported this proposed change. The next change staff are proposing would be the expansion of doe days in 41 counties in the portions of the Blackland Prairie and Post Oak Savannah ecoregions. Staff would be considering two different doe day season structures, one for those counties in yellow that currently have a four-day season, and another season structure for the counties in green that currently, where antlers harvest is currently by MLD only during general season. Within this region, regulatory deer surveys indicate a positive trend in the population, ranging from a 4.8% estimated average annual increase in the population in the yellow counties and a 3.1% average annual increase in the green counties over the last 11 to 13 years. Our big game harvest surveys also indicate about 41% of the total harvest is comprised of antlerless deer, which may contribute to the skewed sex ratio in these regions, with 3.8 does per buck in the yellow counties and 4.2 does per buck in those green counties. Additionally, MLD participation is high in these regions, with over 4,800 management units enrolled in the MLD program. The majority of these properties in this area are associated with wildlife management associations or cooperatives, and they receive antlerless MLD tags to the co-op's MLD enrollment. It's especially true, again, in those green counties where antlerless take is by MLD only during that general season. Additionally, our MLD harvest data indicates that about 56% of the recommended antlerless harvest is achieved each year on average, which suggests that the MLD participation alone is not sufficient to address deer population growth in those particular areas there. More importantly, staff have been receiving requests over the last 5 to 7 years from many constituents in this area asking for short doe seasons as an alternative to the Managed Lands Deer Program. And so by expanding DOE Day, staff would expect to be able to address these requests from the public to have an option for antlerless harvest other than MLD, as well as provide additional hunting opportunities, reduce the potential impacts of deer browsing on native habitats, and relieve pressure on buck harvest in this region. Therefore, staff are proposing in these 20 counties to expand the current four-day doe season to 16 days that would run the first 16 days of general season. To date, we received 236 comments with 81% in support of these proposed changes in these 20 counties and 19% not in support of this proposed change. And the summing up all the those that provided comments not in support of the proposal, generally it comes down to they were concerned that overharvest would occur at a localized scale in their particular area. Additionally, the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee had also reviewed that proposal and was supportive of that change as well. So in these 21 counties, staff are proposing to open a four-day doe season that runs from Thanksgiving Day through the Sunday immediately following Thanksgiving Day with a bag limit of two does during all seasons combined. And as a reminder, MLD harvest, again, is by MLD only and has been that way since 1996. And landowners and hunters in these particular suite of counties have been reluctant to support Doe Day opening a Doe Day season in the past years until more recently. And so staff doesn't believe there will be any issue with opening a four-day doe season, but we are aware of the concerns of possible overharvest voiced by some of these landowners. So to help ease concerns, staff would also propose an experimental mandatory harvest reporting of antlerless deer in these 21 counties. Now, only antlerless deer harvested and tagged with a hunting license tag would need to be reported within 24 hours of harvest, and this will be accomplished using the My Texas Hunt Harvest app available on mobile devices or the department website. It's also being currently used for eastern turkey reporting. Now, MLD antlerless harvest is already required to be reported for all MLD properties, so this proposed change would not affect those MLD reporting requirements. And again, the mandatory reporting would allow staff to accurately obtain harvest information so we can assess the impact of this regulation on that deer population and address requests by some of these landowners in the area to monitor harvest closely. To date, we received 357 comments, 61% in support of the proposed change, 39% in disagreement. Again, primary concerns were overharvest or lack of deer in those particular areas, and some were concerned that there would be reduced participation in the wildlife management associations in these this particular region. Staff also solicited feedback from the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, and they were supportive of the proposed change. We did have one member of the committee that suggested that staff consider increasing the harvest rate for the harvest option MLD program to allow more doe harvest or antlerless harvest through that means rather than expanding doe days in these four counties. The next change is regards to mule deer antler restrictions. If this commission recall, experimental mule deer antler restrictions were implemented in six counties in the panhandle, those in the blue there, in the 2018-19 season, and specifically, again, those counties outlined in blue. Additionally, a mule deer season was opened in Linn County for the first time in the 2018-19 season. And during last spring's regulation adoption process of the mule deer season in Linn County, the department received a number of comments from hunters and landowners asking for the experimental antler restriction regulation to be placed in Linn County. Therefore, staff have proposed to include Linn County in an antler restriction experiment and are seeking adoption of this proposal. Staff believe the inclusion of Linn County to the experimental antler restriction would provide valuable data regarding the success of antler restrictions to maintain an older age buck structure, age buck age structure, and natural sex ratio since this past November was the first ever mule deer season in Linn County. The antler restriction regulation limits the harvest to any buck with an outside spread of the main beams of 20 inches or greater, and bucks with a spread of less than 20 inches are not legal for harvest. In addition, the experimental antler restriction does not apply to MLD properties because the department provides site-specific harvest recommendations that are generally conservative on these MLD properties. Staff also will continue to monitor the success of the experimental antler restriction regulation using population surveys and voluntary check stations to collect more antler and ear measurement data, as well as buck age structure data, and also conduct opinion surveys of hunters and landowners and their support of this regulation. To date, there are 103 comments, with 90% in support of the proposed change and 10% not in support of the proposed change. Those that provided comment not in support indicated that it would be difficult for hunters to judge whether a buck was legal for harvest or had a 20-inch outside spread of the main beams, or that this regulation favors trophy hunting and that hunters should be able to take any buck they like or takes away from the spirit of the hunt itself. And the last proposal is regarding javelina season. Currently, there are 43 counties in the north zone denoted by those counties in yellow with javelina season that runs 151 days from October 1 to the end of February. And another 50 counties in the south zone, those in green that have the season open year-round, and the counties in gray have a closed season. Current javelina range is primarily restricted to South Texas Plains, the western edge of the Edwards Plateau, Trans-Pecos, and portions of the Rolling Plains that are designated by that red crosshatching on the map that you see. You'll note that the range has expanded beyond the current javelina season in portions of the southern plains and southeast panhandle, where those counties that currently have a season, you see it's expanded northward or northwestward. And over the last several years, both law enforcement and wildlife division staff have received a number of reports from hunters and landowners on the increased number of javelina sightings and have requested to open a javelina season in these areas. Therefore, staff are proposing to add these six counties, which include Borden, Dawson, Gaines, Hardeman, Scurry, and Terry counties, to the current suite of counties in the north zone, in which the season runs from October 1 through the last Sunday in February with a bag limit of two javelinas. Staff see no biological concerns with the expanding of the javelina season in these counties. To date, there are 101 public comments, 96% in support, 4% not in support of the proposed change. Those commenting suggested that the population was not sufficient to support harvest in those counties. And on the other hand, we had an individual that thought the bag limit needed to be increased in those counties. So that summarizes the public comment for the javelinas. And that concludes my presentation. So I'll be glad to answer any questions if there is any.
Members, any questions or comments?
Just a comment. Whoever's in this 4% that disagrees that says the population is not sufficient to support harvest has never been to South Texas.
Anybody else, question or comment? Okay, thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Sean Oldenberger.
Jesus.
Good morning, Chairman, fellow commissioners. For the record, my name is Sean Oldenberger. I'm the Small Game Program Director here in the Wildlife Division. Today I'm going to present some information for tomorrow for recommended adoption of proposed changes. So I'll continue where Alan left off on the statewide hunting proclamation and then continue on to the migratory game bird proclamation. So we do have one recommendation proposal for statewide hunting proclamation with regard to wild turkeys. And basically, this is a language cleanup for proof of sex. We've had some confusion from our constituents as far as what they need to have on them when they're transporting a turkey, basically, from the field basically to their permanent residence. And so the language there is in front of you, and I'll read it. It's basically we're changing language to saying during a season in which the bag composition for turkey is restricted to gobblers only or gobblers and bearded hens. A proof of sex must remain with a harvested turkey, attached or detached from the bird, until it reaches either the processor's or possessor's permanent residence or a cold storage processing facility and is finally processed. We'd also have a little bit of language cleanup on regards to proof of sex for both gobbler and bearded hen as well. And basically a gobbler would be, for proof of sex, one leg including the spur or a patch of skin with breast feathers and beard attached. For the bearded hen, a female turkey, basically be a patch of skin with breast feathers and beard attached. Basically, we believe this will be decrease the amount of confusion from our constituents and put in a little bit more plain language as far as regulation when it goes in the outdoor annual, so that won't be confusing from our constituents and hunters in the future. Just for some public comment, we had 125 online, 120 or 96% agreed completely. We had 5 disagree completely. There was some concern from one individual about using previous year's proof of sex. And just to let you know as well, the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee unanimously supported this proposal as well. Moving on to proposals for Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. And just to give you some background here for Migratory Game Bird information available, a few years ago, Fish and Wildlife Service changed the process as far as season setting, so therefore there is no early and late season regulation process with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and therefore we would be recommending to combine the early and late season migratory game bird proclamations into one. And also the federal frameworks are basically the football field that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service sets for us as a state is basically unchanged for the geese, dove, and other migratory game birds except ducks. They did extend the federal frameworks closing date from the last Sunday in January to January 31st for your information. So proposed changes for waterfowl and doves, daily bag limits are the same this year as previous, except pintails will decrease from 2 per day to 1 per day. That's due to the national harvest strategy for northern pintails that all 4 flyways in the Fish and Wildlife Service have signed off on. So that keeps flipping back from 2 to 1 to 2. All other migratory game birds coincide with waterfowl season, and calendar adjustments were necessary on most other species. And just also for information, the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee completely supported these proposals as well. We do have in attendance to Mr. James Prince, who is actually the chair of the Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee as well. And so to give you some information on statewide regular dove seasons. Actually, James, you want to stand up? He'll get me back for that one.
So thank you for joining.
As you can see in front of you, here's the statewide regular dove seasons. There's 3 zones in the state of Texas. It's maximum we're allowed underneath federal frameworks as well. We do have a 90-day season. We're allowed 15 birds in the daily bag limit, and that's an aggregate of white-winged doves and mourning doves. We are also allowed 2 white-tipped doves in the daily bag limit, but those mostly reside in South Texas. And so we'll start with season proposals for the north zone. We can only go as early as September 1st, so therefore in the north zone we'd start September 1st, run to November 12th, and then start again December 20th, and run out the rest of the days to January 5th. Central zone, once again, starting as early as possible on September 1st, running there through November 3rd, starting again, once again, on December 20th, and running out the rest of the days to January 14th. Last year, the chairman asked us to go to the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee and get a kind of a policy per se for our south zones due to a federal framework change we did have there. Basically, the opening day used to be the Friday closest to September 20th, but no earlier than September 17th, and that got changed to a fixed date basically as early as September 14th a couple years ago through the Fish and Wildlife Service process. And so basically we came up with a starting policy, which helps us as, you know, basically where we can start the process with our technical and advisory committees. And basically it says the first segment would start September 14th and run to the first Sunday in November. Second segment would start the third or fourth Friday in December and run out the end of available days. Actually capture MLK weekend every year. And once again, the advisory committee supported this. And so therefore, the South Zone and special white-winged dove days follow this. And special white-winged dove days are proposed to be September 1st, 2nd, and 7th, and 8th, and we're allowed 15 birds in the daily bag limit there, but only 2 mourning doves. That's a special season underneath U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service season setting, so therefore we're not allowed more than 2 mourning doves. Regular season starts September 14th, run November 3rd, starting in December 20th as the other two seasons and run out to January 23rd. To see this on basically a calendar, and see there you can see the yellow would be the special white-winged dove days. That's the afternoon-only season. And just for your information, you see that's a Sunday, Monday starting. That's the same kind of season structure we had in 2013 when we had these very similar dates due to calendar progression. And then we'd start the regular season there on September 14th, early as possible underneath the federal frameworks, and run to November 3rd, open again December 20th, as I said previously, run out the rest of the days to January 23rd. Moving on from does, we'll get the waterfall proposals for teal hunting. We're allowed 16 days underneath the federal frameworks. Staff preference has always been the last three full weekends of September to capture the most of the blue wing migration that occurs here in Texas. So therefore, the proposed dates would be September 14th to 29th. We're allowed six birds in the daily bag limit. That's an aggregate. That's blue wing teal, cinnamon teal, or green wing teal. But obviously here in Texas, we're harvesting mostly blue wing teal coming from the Dakotas and Canada and passing through here through the wintering grounds. Moving on to the High Plains Mallard Management Unit, there you can see highlighted in orange in the state of Texas for ducks, mergansers, and coots. And this is regular use seasons as proposed would be October 19th and 20th. Regular season would be October 26th to 27th. We'd open again on November 1st. That's a traditional Friday opener and run to the last Sunday in January. For all zones in the state of Texas, we have a five-day delay on dusky ducks. That's for the protection of model ducks that the Fish and Wildlife Service set a number of years ago. To look at this on the calendar here, you can see teal season highlighted in basically light blue, and dark blue would be the use season and the regular season in green. So it's a little bit different structure here. We're allowed a few more days in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit underneath federal frameworks compared to the north and south zones. Moving on to regular for seasons in the north zone, highlighted there in green on the map, youth would be, as proposed, November 2nd and 3rd. Regular season will start November 9th, run to December 1st, so we can make sure we capture Halloween weekend there, and then or Thanksgiving weekend, sorry, and then open December 7th and run out to last Sunday in January. And once again, dusky ducks are delayed 5 days in north zone, even though there are not many there in that area. Here's what it looks like on a calendar. Once again, in light blue there is teal season, the youth season being in a darker blue, and the regular season being in green. Moving on to the last zone for ducks, mergansers and coots in Texas, the south zone there highlighted in yellow. Youth be October 26th and 27th as proposed. Regular season would start November 2nd, run to December 1st, open again December 14th, and run out to the last Sunday in January as well, being the 26th. Here we have a five-day delay in dusky ducks as well, so therefore season would not begin until November 7th. Here's what it looks like on a calendar as well. Once again, light blue there in is teal season, dark blue being youth season, and green being the regular season. So for daily bag limits for ducks, mergansers, and coots, proposed bag limits statewide, ducks are six per day, five mallards, only two which may be hens, three wood ducks, three stock, two redheads, two canvasbacks, one pintail, there's highlighted in yellow, that would be the change. One dusky duck in there. If you were wondering what a dusky duck is, it's defined a mottled black or Mexican-like duck after the first 5 days. All others are six. Mergansers, five per day, with only which two may be hooded mergansers. Coots, 15 per day, and possession limit is three times the daily bag limit for all migratory game birds unless otherwise stated. Moving on to geese, proposed dates for geese. There you'll see the western goose zone highlighted in red, and in light blue is the eastern goose zone. A few years ago, we made a change where actually we have consistent now daily bag limits across both zones. So we have five dark geese to include no more than two white-fringed geese and 20 light geese with no possession limit there. In the red there, western goose zone, dark geese and light geese are concurrent for November 2nd to February 2nd. And the conservation order for light geese only, where we do have some special methods allowed there for take, start directly after, which on February 3rd and run to March 15th. Eastern goose zone, we do have a Canada goose only season that runs concurrent with our teal season from September 14th to 29th as proposed. Basically, that's to take advantage of some nesting Canada geese we have in northeast Texas. Traditionally, there weren't many nesting Canada geese actually in the state of Texas. Dark and light geese would start as well November 2nd and run out to January 26th, which is the closing date for ducks. The conservation order would start January 27th and run to March 15th as proposed. Moving on to Sam O'Cranes, in Zone A, they're in light blue, basically in the High Plains in Trans-Pecos of Texas. We can start October 26th as proposed and run to January 26th. Daily bag limit there is allowed is 3. This is a 93-day season. Zone B, which is highlighted in green, would start November 22nd as proposed and run out to January 26th. Just for your information, we do delay crane season in Zone B to allow whooping crane migration through that area. That's the primary migration area through that area across the Red River down there to Aransas National Wildlife Refuge and surrounding lands on the coast of Texas. Zone C, which is highlighted in red, we have a reduced season there underneath federal frameworks, and that would, as proposed, start December 14th and run to January 19th, and we're only allowed 2 birds there in our daily bag limit underneath federal frameworks as well. Moving on to rail gallinules, moorhens, snipe, and woodcock. Rail gallinule and moorhens would be concurrent with teal season, as proposed, September 14th to 29th, starting again November 2nd, running to Christmas. Snipe, we're allowed 107-day season there, starting October 26th, I'll get that out, and running to February 9th. Woodcock is a 45-day season. We're allowed 3 birds in the daily bag limit. End of federal forms there is January 31st. We back up, so therefore that's no change from the previous year. Starting date, December 18th. Proposed falconry seasons for mourning white wing and white tip doves as proposed, November 16th and December 2nd. Just some additional days of opportunity for our falconers in the state, where we do have about 250 to 300 or so. For woodcock, moorhen, gallinule, rail, ducks in the north and south zones, January 27th to February 9th. We do not have a falconry-only season in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit because we already allocate 107 days for take on ducks in that area, which were only allowed underneath the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And so for public comment, we received a small number of public comment on this proposal. 19 of 26, or 73%, agreed completely. 1 disagreed completely, and 6 disagreed specifically on various items. Those items would be increased woodcock daily bag limit, increased pintail daily bag limit. Those first two we cannot do. We cannot be more liberal than federal frameworks, so those are not options for the state. The other are later snipe closure, reduced bag limits in possession for ducks and geese, and then to have duck and deer season on the same weekend, although the zone was not specified there. And then also for south zone for doves is basically returning to the historical opening day is what we had one comment on. So with that, I'll take any questions with regards to the proposals that will go in front of you for adoption tomorrow if authorized.
Members, any questions or comments? All right, thank you. I'll place the 2019-20 statewide hunting and migratory game bird proclamations on the Wednesday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action by this commission. Item number 6, proposed deer breeder regulations regarding chronic wasting disease testing provisions and release provisions. Mitch Lockwood.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood. I'm the Big Game Program Director in the Wildlife Division. And tomorrow, I will seek adoption of proposed amendments to rules pertaining to deer breeding activities. Specifically, those amendments would create additional CWD testing options for deer breeding facilities that are currently prohibited from transferring deer into or out of their facility, and would extend the period of time that breeder deer may be confined in a soft release pen or an acclimation pen before finally being liberated on a release site. Regarding the first proposed amendment, there are approximately 155 deer breeding facilities that are currently not movement qualified because of inadequate CWD surveillance. And when I say not movement qualified, I mean just that. They are not qualified to move deer into or out of their facility. And just over 100 of those facilities currently have enough test eligible deer in their facilities to meet the surveillance requirements in order to regain movement qualified status, and they would do that through live animal testing or antimortem testing options that we provide. But there are several facilities, in fact, a little bit more than 50 facilities, that do not have enough deer to meet the surveillance requirements under current rule to regain movement qualified status. In fact, some of these facilities will never have enough deer to regain movement qualified status. Well, they're essentially under a permanent quarantine order. And so to address this concern, I proposed an amendment to our breeder user group, which would involve antemortem testing of the entire herd one time, and then following that, designating that facility or classifying that facility with what we call a TC3 status, meaning any recipient release site would receive a Class 3 status, meaning any deer released on those Class 3 sites would have an RFID button tag attached in the ear, and would any deer harvested on those sites would have to be tested for CWD. The breeder user group liked that idea, and they also offered an alternate proposal, which in order to avoid that TC3 designation and ultimately Class 3 designation for release sites, they proposed to allow two rounds of whole herd antemortem testing over a 24-month period. So we took those two options, or proposed amendments to our CWD task force, and the CWD task force was concerned with the first idea. They were concerned with the amount of risk that one round of live animal testing would pose to the native deer population, and they advised that we proceed with the proposal, the second option, if you will, the proposal that would require two rounds of antemortem testing over a 24-month period. So with that, staff did propose to allow breeding facilities who are in this situation to regain movement qualified status after two rounds of whole herd antemortem or live animal testing. And there's a not detected test result for every single test eligible animal in the facility. The first round of testing would occur at least 12 months after that facility has been determined to be a closed facility. In other words, after their status was changed to not movement qualified and the department was able to identify all of the deer in the inventory. Then the second round of whole herd testing would occur at least 12 months after that first round. Now, the second aspect of this proposal would extend the period of time.
Before you go to the soft release proposal, are there any questions or comments about the first part? I think that it might be a good plan for staff to continue to have a dialogue with the CWD task force to explore if there are any other reliable alternatives to these, not to in any way to suggest these aren't appropriate, but just to continue that dialogue to look for potential other solutions to deal with this situation.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay. Proceed on the soft release then.
Okay. So the second aspect of this proposal would extend the period of time that breeder deer may be confined in a soft release pen, which I may also refer to as an acclimation pen. I tend to use those terms interchangeably. And this would be the period of time in which they're placed in one of these pens prior to eventually being liberated onto a release site. I don't plan to go in as much detail in my presentation this morning as I did at the January Commission meeting, but I'm often reminded that the details of this are a lot more complicated than I might think since I deal with it on a daily basis. And so please don't hesitate to let me know if I need to stop and clarify anything that I'm discussing. I will refresh your memories that a deer breeding facility can release deer directly to a release site, or that deer breeder may choose to place those deer in one of these soft release pens or acclimation pens for a period not to exceed 30 days. And the reason we call them acclimation pens is because the intent of this was to provide deer ample time to acclimate to their new surroundings before ultimately being released onto this larger release site. And I say acclimate, I mean physiologically acclimate to this environment. Some may even argue behaviorally acclimate. But this practice of releasing deer has evolved over years, and an increasing number of deer breeders have been moving deer more towards a model of what involves an extended period of detention and what I'm going to refer to as de facto soft release pens. Rather than obtaining a soft release authorization, there are some who are fragmenting or subdividing their release sites by fencing off a small portion of the release site and basically transferring deer to that and then registering that smaller portion as a release site and then transferring deer directly to that smaller release site. And they're doing this because they would like to they're doing this for purposes more than just acclimation, and they'd like to keep those deer in that smaller site for a period longer than 30 days before ultimately opening the gates and providing them access to the larger site. The reasons for this include things like placing bred does in there this time of year, and then leaving them in there long enough to drop their fawns in the pens, and then raise the fawns until they're at heel, and then ultimately release them into the larger site. Or some have chosen to place, say, bucks in there at a young age and then grow them out in one of these sites for 2, 3, 4 years and then ultimately release them to the larger site. Or they may place a buck with some does in one of these small release sites and have them breed for 1 season, 2 seasons, 3 seasons, and then ultimately release those animals, or I should say open the gates and provide those animals access to the larger release site. And that whole time those deer in that pen, they might be legally harvesting deer on the larger release site, essentially replacing the population with a deer that they've confined in that smaller site for a few years. Now, this practice, though, with few exceptions, is no longer allowed because this commission adopted rules in June of 2016 that we refer to as the comprehensive CWD rules. And in that rule package, it states that no person may intentionally cause or allow any live deer to leave or escape from a release site onto which breeder deer have been liberated. And the idea behind this is these release sites should be, for lack of a better phrase, terminal facilities. The risk that is associated with transferring deer to these sites is intended to stay at that site and not expose other areas with that same level of risk. Of course, there are some exceptions to this, such as when a release site owner may purchase adjacent or adjoining land and want to incorporate that into the management plan and extend a fence around the adjoining land too. And so there certainly have been several amendments to these release sites to allow for that. What this means is, before I move to that next slide, I should state that to do this, what we do is we manually amend these sites by consolidating, in that example, 2 sites, or we may even need to subdivide sites upon the sale of if a landowner sells a portion of a site, then we may manually go in the system and adjust this, amend the site, the size of these sites, whether it's growing the site or subdividing the site. And that's not a difficult process to do, provided it's a one-time process. But it would become very difficult to do administratively in our existing online application if this were to be a repeated process where sites were to consolidate and subdivide on a repeated basis. And so what this means is that if someone wants to use a soft, engage in this practice of placing deer in a smaller area for some period of time before ultimately giving them access to a larger site, they would need to utilize the soft release provision. But we realize that the 30 days that's currently authorized isn't as long as what some people would prefer for reasons that I provided this morning, such as allowing fawns to be dropped in and raised until they're old enough to release when they're at heel with the does. And so staff, to accommodate that, staff have proposed to amend the rules to state that breeder deer may lawfully be transferred to a registered release site. I'll start over with that. Deer that are lawfully transferred to a registered release site may be held in temporary captivity for any period of time between March 1 through the 11th day immediately preceding an open deer season, to acclimate the breeder deer to habitat conditions at the release site. So this would be an extension from 30 days to more than 6 months. This ending date is very important for 2 reasons. First, it is consistent with what is commonly referred to as the 10-day rule. Statutes or Parks and Wildlife Code state that deer cannot be released with antlers intact during an open season or within the 10-day period immediately preceding an open season. And this proposal would allow bucks to be released from a soft release pen with antlers intact and not conflict with that statute. Secondly, this ending date is important so that deer are released before breeding season begins, because detaining does with one or more bucks during a breeding season requires a permit, either a deer breeding permit or a DMP, or deer management permit. Following the breeder user group meeting where this was discussed at length, some of us with the department had a conference call with the leadership of Texas Deer Association, and during that conversation it became quite obvious to us that the rules needed to clearly state the requirements for facilitating that release. And we believe those requirements should be consistent with the requirements for facilitating release under a deer management permit, or DMP. Therefore, we proposed that the release shall consist of the removal of at least 20 feet of the components of a pen that serve to maintain deer in a state of detention within the pen. However, no opening shall be less than 10 feet in width. Such components should be removed for no fewer than 30 consecutive days. Again, this is consistent with the requirements we currently have for facilitating release from a DMP. This essentially would require the opening of two 10-foot gates. Again, these proposals have been presented to the breeder user group. The first proposed amendment I shared with you this morning has been presented to the CWD task force. And then both of these proposals have been presented to the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. With the exception of one member of the breeder user group, all of that committee supports the proposals that you will consider tomorrow. As I've already shared with you, the CWD task force did have concern with one of the options that was provided to them, which was the single round of whole herd testing. But they do support the proposal that was published in the Texas Register for two rounds of whole herd testing over a 24-month period. And staff also heard the request of the chairman to consider continue dialogue with the CWD task force to continue considering potential for other options down the road. The Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee also was supportive of the proposal for providing that additional option for regaining movement qualified status. There were several members of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee who have concerns with the proposed amendments for soft release. While the soft release provision doesn't authorize individuals to handle deer, people with a soft release pen don't have the same privileges and benefits that a deer breeder would have with a deer breeder permit, such as being able to handle those deer. Nonetheless, many members of that advisory committee referred to these soft release pens as an extension of a deer breeding facility or satellite breeding pens. Some would refer them as. And they had concern with this because they don't come with the same obligations that come with a deer breeding permit, such as the requirement to report mortalities, the requirement to test the percentage of those mortalities for CWD. Now, I should be clear that this proposal does not introduce any new liberties, any new risks that lead to these concerns. Rather, these concerns that they presented are really in existence now with current rules and procedures that are in place. And committee members, they understand that. In fact, they actually provided some recommendations to address their concerns, such as compliance with the department stocking policy as is done with our triple T permits. But unless otherwise directed by this commission this morning, and as long as the department continues to with our current procedures for registering release sites, which does not take into consideration the department stocking policy, the staff intend to recommend adoption of these proposed amendments during the meeting tomorrow. And that concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Carter, you have something?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm thinking about this. Obviously, a couple of really important issues for the commission to be considering, and there are a number of different dimensions to them. And certainly, Mitch has done a terrific job reaching out to the many interested and rather diverse stakeholders who have a real interest in what you do in this regard. Certainly, I will offer my opinion that with regard to the testing option, that I hope y'all will be able to move forward with that. And I like the guidance you shared, Chairman, for us to go back to the CWD task force to see if there are any additional ideas that we could come back in May for y'all to consider. I might respectfully suggest that we modify Mitch's proposal on the soft release permit. I think there's a lot that we can and should learn about how the permitted breeders are using the soft release permits, you know, for how long, what purpose, numbers of deer, et cetera. I think it would be in our best interest maybe to consider, you know, a pilot proposal of a year on that front. See if the permit is meeting the needs of the permittees and their various management needs, but also give us a chance to, I think, learn more about these soft release permits as a whole, collect some data, and then come back to y'all in a year to talk further about that and see if you want to extend it or if it would behoove you to modify it or alignment again to better facilitate the commission's goals and the various management needs are out there. So I guess I'd respectfully suggest that maybe y'all consider modifying Mitch's proposal for a pilot 1 year a study on the soft release extension.
I like the suggestion.
One question, Carter, on if we go that route, or maybe Mitch, one, either or both, what is that going to do to the people that are caught in that trap right now? That, you know, and it's sure. A sizable number, you know, what, 135, 140 people. How are we going to overcome that situation in the short term to alleviate that headache that I know is a big headache for you as well?
So let me just, I want to be clear. My suggestion didn't have anything to do with that testing requirement that you talked about. Mine was simply limited to the proposal to extend the provisions for the term of the soft release. So if you were to go forward with approving tomorrow the testing criteria for those breeders that are caught in a situation in which they can't currently test their way out to become movement qualified, then that would then give at least some of those breeders an option to start testing now. But the one-year pilot that I was suggesting, just to be clear, would pertain only to that soft release provision.
Only to the soft release.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, if I may clarify,
please.
Carter, they're currently, it's right at about 55 facilities that currently do not have enough deer under the current rules that are essentially under a hold order for an extended period of time. And of those 55, 30, you know, I talked about a two-year period that this two rounds of testing would occur, but actually 31 of those facilities could initiate that live animal testing today or as soon as this were adopted. Well, they could do it today. And so really it's really not a two-year period at this point because we've already been working with many of these facilities for some time. In fact, the latest that any of these facilities, the longest it would take for any of these facilities to have their first round of live animal testing would be still less than a year away. It'd be next January, and there's only two of those 55 facilities that fall into that category.
Mm-hmm.
So the deer breeding permit, go back to, I think it may be clear, the slide with the deer breeding facility going to release site two and then out from there. So someone who has this, they have to have a deer breeding permit if the deer are in the deer breeding facility, and then it goes to a deer management permit when they go to the soft release and release sites?
No, ma'am. You're close.
Okay.
But a deer management permit in this case, I tried not to get into the deer management permit discussion today to further complicate things. But deer management permit is not required in this example that I have. Somebody who's has deer in a deer breeding facility would need a deer breeder permit, and that is the only permit that would be required for anything you see on the slide before you today.
Okay. And all of these are high-fenced areas.
They are all high-fenced areas in this example, yes. And a release site must have a high fence as per current regulation in the comprehensive CWD rules.
Thank you.
Anybody else, questions or comments? Okay. I'm going to authorize the proposed changes to be placed on tomorrow's agenda item for public comment and action with one exception, and that is on the soft release provisions, that would be on a one-year sunset, so that next year the commission will hear an update this time from staff and consider whether to extend, modify, suspend, or revoke. With that change, we'll proceed tomorrow with a vote on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right. Dr. Dittmar, Bob Dittmar, please give us work session item 7, disease detection and response rules for proposed amendment to containment zone boundaries.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, my name is Bob Dittmar. I'm the veterinarian for the Wildlife Division, and I'm here this morning to request permission to publish amendments to Chapter 65.81 concerning disease detection and response to expand the boundaries of Containment Zone 3. And I better get my clicker here ahead now. Just to remind everyone, there are three areas in the state where chronic wasting disease has been detected. Within those areas have been designated containment and surveillance zones with rules in place to monitor the disease through testing, surveillance, and to contain the disease through restrictions on movement of live animals and those carcass parts that are most likely to be infectious. The slide depicts the current delineations of containment zone 3 and surveillance zone 3, as well as the approximate locations of CWD positives in the area. And just the red dots are white-tailed deer. The purplish-colored dots are elk. To date, there have been 94 positive white-tailed deer in permitted breeding facilities, 14 positive white-tailed deer and 2 positive elk harvested on permitted sites associated with those permitted breeder facilities, and 3 positive white-tailed deer harvested outside those permitted facilities in Containment Zone 3. The department, along with Texas Animal Health Commission, designated the boundaries of the surveillance zone using easily recognized geographic boundaries such as roads and streams. The boundaries of the containment zone in this area were delineated using a 2-mile buffer around the boundaries of positive permitted facilities and 5 miles around the location of positive free-ranging deer harvested outside of those facilities. As the rules for mandatory testing of harvest and carcass movement restrictions are the same for both zones, hunters need only to know the boundaries of the surveillance zones to be in compliance. Only permitted facilities which can move live deer are affected by other zone restrictions, whether they're in the containment zone or the surveillance zone. And the department can determine the location of those permitted facilities and notify them of any restrictions under the rules. In very late December of this past year, 2018, we received confirmation from National Vet Services Laboratory of a positive white-tailed deer harvested outside a permitted facility, but within the current containment zone 3. Staff has determined to be consistent with a 5-mile buffer for this free-ranging animal. In all directions, a slight expansion of the containment zone is needed. The department has determined there are no permitted facilities within this extension that would be affected by this change. And also, as there is no extension of Surveillance Zone 3, there would be no change in regulations to current property use of other landowners included in those new boundaries. Another free-ranging white-tailed deer was harvested and found to be positive in February 2019 within the current boundaries of Containment Zone 3. This deer is within the current 5-mile buffer, so that deer would not require any expansion of the zone. And this is just another view of those proposed expansion of that zone, along with some road and stream features that just help delineate this area. For orientation, Hondo is down in the lower right-hand corner. Tarpley is up in the upper right-hand corner. Utopia is in the upper left-hand corner, and Sabinal in the lower left-hand corner. And it's within, basically defines the boundaries of the surveillance zone. So our request today is that our staff seeks permission to publish proposed amendments to Chapter 65.81 concerning disease detection in response to expand the boundaries of Containment Zone 3 in the Texas Register. And that completes my presentation. If I have any questions.
Members, any questions or comments? All right. Thank you, Dr. Dittmar. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item 8, for public lands proclamation, request permission to publish proposed changes. Justin Drivelbus.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Justin Drivelbus. I'm the Private Lands and Public Hunting Program Director in the Wildlife Division. In 2018, this commission made certain arrow guns and air guns lawful for the take of game animals and non-migratory birds. Staff has determined that because the current rules governing the use of public hunting lands are silent on the subject of arrow guns and air guns, that changes were necessary with respect to possession, display, and use of these pneumatic weapons on public lands. This morning, I'll briefly cover a few proposed amendments to the Public Lands Proclamation and request permission to publish in the Texas Register. The first proposed amendment to Section 65.199 would prohibit the possession of arrow guns and air guns on public hunting lands except for permitted hunters, permitted researchers, commissioned law enforcement officers, and department employees in performance of their duties. The second amendment, 65201, would make it unlawful for a person to possess a loaded arrow gun or air gun in a vehicle unless the person falls into a certain category of disabled hunters that may hunt from a stationary vehicle. And then the last group of amendments would be to Section 65.203, which would require hunters using an arrow gun or air gun to comply to certain hunter safety provisions regarding the use of hunter orange or the discharge and display of certain weapons. And so at this time, Parks and Wildlife staff seeks permission to publish proposed amendments to Section 65.199, 65.201, and 65.203 of the Public Lands Proclamation concerning the possession, display, and use of pneumatic weapons on public hunting lands in the Texas Register. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Members, any questions or comments? Okay, I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Work session item 9, local park grant funding, request approval of proposed funding recommendations. Dan Reese.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Dan Reese, and I'm the local park grant program manager within the Recreation Grants Branch in the State Park Division. And I'm here this morning to present 38 new local park grant funding recommendations. Funding from a portion of state sporting goods sales tax, as well as federal offshore oil and gas royalties, combined to provide matching grants to local units of government for the acquisition and development of public parkland. Currently available, we have $7,037,012 available in the Texas Recreation and Parks Account, or TRPA. The Texas Large County and Municipality Recreation and Parks Account, or Urban Account, currently has a balance of $5,245,957. And through the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund, or LWCF, we currently have available $3,990,363. And at this point, I would also like to mention that available federal LWCF funding, additional funding, could be made available later during the current fiscal year. We have a total of 5 individual grant programs within local parks. These are each based on population as well as proposed project scope. We have the Urban Outdoor Recreation Program as well as the Urban Indoor Recreation Program, and these are both for communities with a population of 500,000 or more. We have the Non-Urban Outdoor Recreation and Non-Urban Indoor Recreation Programs, and these are for communities with a population of less than 500,000. And then we also have the Small Community Recreation Program, and this is for all eligible jurisdictions with a population of 20,000 or less. Each of the 5 programs listed here were offered during the current grant cycle. We have an annual call for applications Our most recent deadline was October 1st of last year, 2018. As of that date, we received a total of 71 eligible local park applications, requesting a total of $25,377,315 in matching fund assistance. Exhibits A through E rank projects in descending order based on each grant program scoring criteria, which was previously adopted by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission. Exhibit F displays the scoring for the Webb County non-urban outdoor application. Based on this application score, staff is prepared to recommend the funding of this application. So these are the three motions that we're prepared to present tomorrow. Motion one, staff recommends the funding for projects listed in exhibits A through E. Funding for projects listed in exhibits A through E is approved in the amount of $16,005,139. Proposed motion two, funding for projects listed in exhibit F is approved in the amount of $248,000. And again, this is specific to the non-urban outdoor application submitted by Webb County. And motion three, as I mentioned a little earlier, we do have the possibility of obtaining additional federal funding later in the current fiscal year. In the event this occurs, motion three reads, funding for projects listed in exhibits A through B, A and B, is approved in the amount of additional LWCF funding that is made available in the current fiscal year, not to exceed $6 million, with first priority given to urban outdoor applications. At this point, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Members, any questions or comments?
Chairman, I'm not sure if this is the appropriate time, but I do want to let you know that I will be abstaining on Exhibit F, dealing with the Webb County non-urban outdoor application, because my husband is a Webb County commissioner.
Okay, so you're recusing on motion two.
Yes, recusing.
Okay. All right. Thank you. My only hesitation on the recommendation is the proposed priority to urban outdoor. I suggest we give priority to all outdoor, not just urban. So both non-urban, the smaller communities aren't de-preferenced.
Okay.
Adjust that tomorrow.
Adjust that. Okay.
Okay, with that adjustment, read the magic language here. The local park grant funding request approval of the three proposed funding recommendations will be placed on the Wednesday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, with regard to work session item 10, disposition of real estate in Brazoria County, approximately 355 acres for dredge placement area at Bryan Beach. Does any commissioner have any questions or comments on this? Has been previously presented. If not, I'll place it on tomorrow's agenda for action. All right. So the disposition of real estate in Brazoria County, 355 acres, will be placed on Wednesday's commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Work session item 11, disposition of property in Jasper County, approximately 219 acres of land, and a permit for 811 acre-feet of water at the Jasper Fish Hatchery, Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, commissioners, good morning. My name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is to discuss the prospect of disposition of a site that we've used for many, many, many decades and no longer use, originally known as the Jasper County Fish Hatchery, or the Jasper County Fish Hatchery, and more recently known as the East Texas Conservation Center, just northwest of Jasper, Texas. We had the opportunity to discuss this a few months ago, and you asked us to go back and do some additional research, which we've done. And just briefly, to refresh your memory, we acquired that property in the 20s and 30s, expanded it in 1947. At one time, it was one of our very active fish hatcheries, producing 30% of the Florida largemouth bass fingerlings and 100% of the blue catfish fingerlings that we stocked in public waters in Texas. With the East Texas Fish Hatchery and the John Parker Fish Hatchery coming online early in this century, the production of those fingerlings was shifted to those newer, more modern facilities, and ultimately ceased at the Jasper Fish Hatchery. At that point, the facility was transferred to Wildlife Division. They used it for a few years to support District 6 operations in East Texas. Again, it was called the East Texas Conservation Center. Those facilities have since been moved to other locations. The site's about 219 acres, includes about 70 acres of forest. I believe there are 63 hatchery ponds altogether. There are offices, hatchery buildings, and a residence, some of which do date to the 1930s. In 1931, the Game and Oyster Commission acquired a water right to divert up to 811 acre feet per year out of Indian Creek to keep those ponds full of water for fingerling production. Technically, the permit is for agricultural wildlife management and wetlands use. The property we own includes a diversion structure on Indian Creek, and it's about a 3,500-foot channel that carries that diverted water to those hatchery facilities. You can see in this map the approximate shape of the property, and you can see clearly where that 3,500-foot channel is and where the property is we own straddling Indian Creek, which allows us to maintain that diversion structure. You can see what some of the facilities look like. Again, those older-looking facilities do date to the 1930s. As I mentioned, the District 6 wildlife operations have been relocated to Nacogdoches. There is it's like a greenhouse structure. There's one structure right now on the site that produces giant Salvinia weevils that can be reconstructed at any of several other sites. The older buildings are covered by the Antiquities Code of Texas, which would mean that if we were to dispose of the property, we would need to coordinate with the State Historic Preservation Office and document those structures. But there's a protocol in place for doing that. The property as it sits now has very little value to Parks and Wildlife for administrative, biological, or recreation purposes. It's really too small to manage as a park. And it's been disturbed too much, really, for us to manage it as a wildlife management area. And again, it's just it's been a very, very, very useful facility, but is for our purposes has outlived its usefulness. The property was acquired with state funds, which means there's no federal funds involved. We would not have to go through the process of conversion, which is a fairly complex process. The fact it was purchased with state funds makes it much easier for us to divest of, should you choose to do that. Staff recommends selling the property and dedicating the sale proceeds to acquisition of land with higher strategic value to Parks and Wildlife. The associated water right has financial and conservation value and could be conveyed in whole or in part with the land. Any or all of the water right retained by the department could be dedicated to in-stream use to protect fish and wildlife resources of Indian Creek. The water right, again, 811 acre feet of water up to 811 acre feet of acre feet per year of water can be diverted from Indian Creek. The water right also allows us to keep 225 acre feet of that water impounded at a time on the facility. From 2000 to 2014, which is when we actually have records for, our average diversion was 446 acre feet a year. Most of that water was returned to Indian Creek, and in fact, in about half of those years, we returned more water than we received. Remember, this is Jasper County. Average annual rainfall is 59.8 inches. Average evaporation is about 48 inches, which means in a normal year, you get more rain than you know what to do with. And so the water fills those ponds up and ends up being returned. We end up returning more water to Indian Creek than we actually use. as far as that water goes, in-stream use purposes can be added to that water right, so that that water that we retain and commit to in-stream uses can be guaranteed to become a part of the flow of Indian Creek, and we'll take a little bit closer look at our conclusions about what that means for Indian Creek. If the water is placed in the Texas Water Trust, we retain ownership, but the Water Trust commits that water to be dedicated to in-stream uses for conservation. We started in December sampling, again, per direction we received from the Commission, taking a close look at the dynamics of that stream to get some idea of what that water right would mean for the health of that stream. I want to brag a little bit on our failed sampling team. I think it's known throughout the nation that Parks and Wildlife Department is an exemplary conservation agency, period. And one of the reasons is that we are well-staffed with people who are truly experts in their field, who know how to mobilize and get in the field and do this kind of sampling. And so you can see pictures here of the crew measuring the creek. They took cross sections. They created models, flow models. They looked at the sediments in the creek. They looked at the different types of habitat, the pool habitats and ripple habitats. They collected fish. You can see one of the calmer reaches of that creek here. They collected 14 species of fish in December, which is a very high number of species to collect when the water is this cold. The water, the fish that want to can swim downstream to Angelina River where the water's a little bit warmer during the winter. But again, a very interesting diversity of fish, the dusky darter and southern lamprey being a couple that have to have this ripple habitat for at least part of their life cycle. And to get to the recommendation, staff does recommend divestiture of the Jasper Fish Hatchery. Staff recommends retaining a local broker to maximize the marketing value and the realization of potential land sale value. Staff recommends that the land sale proceeds be dedicated to acquisition of strategic wildlife management area or fish hatchery lands in East Texas. The sale, again, this is staff recommendation that the sale should include some of the agency's water right to increase the tract's marketability. Any balance of the water right not conveyed with the land should be dedicated to in-stream use and considered for deposition in the Texas Water Trust. Staff suggest offering the sale of 200 acre feet per year of water to go with the land and retaining 611 acre feet per year. Staff does recommend a deed restriction that would prohibit the placement of any diversion structure in Indian Creek that would prohibit the upstream or downstream movement of aquatic species. There's more than one way to get water out of that creek. Historically, at one time, we had a dam across the creek that built up some headwater that then the water forced that water down the channel to the hatchery. But based on those species like the southern lamprey that need to be able to move up and down and need that moving water habitat, we recommend that any future diversion not completely block off that creek so as to prohibit the movement of aquatic organisms up and down the creek. Staff request permission to begin the public notice and input process, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We also have folks here who are more experts than I am on water rights and stream dynamics.
Well, I'd like to call on Commissioner Scott, who's been there and evaluated this, to give us share his thoughts on this.
Yeah, I did go out and had a nice tour with all of our people up there who are as good as what Ted said. They're very, very conscientious. I can't see any use for us for this particular piece of land anymore. We've built the new facilities. You know, we've got the whole new fish hatchery and everything. I don't perceive that we would ever have a use. So I think, and I like the way that the staff has prepared the way to go out and market it and to do the water rights and everything. I think they've done a good job. So I would support the sale and the disposition of this and keeping the funds available to use for a more worthwhile piece of dirt that does what we need it to do.
I also assume you didn't mention this, that we would retain the minerals.
It is safe to assume that we will retain the mineral, any minerals that we have associated with that property. Yes, sir.
I want to make sure. All right. I think Carter has a thought or two, an update on another related item pertaining to this proposed agenda item.
Chairman and Commissioners, I do. Just as we go forward, I just want to call your attention on the map of the fish hatchery, and you might pull that up, Ted. And I guess that's on the, and Stephen, you probably know this, the southeastern boundary is a historic cemetery, and we've been approached by the cemetery managers about their interest in potentially acquiring, I think, up to an acre to allow for future expansion of that cemetery. And I guess, Chairman, what we'd be looking for, we think that would be a worthwhile neighborly thing to pursue, to look at selling a little bit of acreage, again, 1 acre or so, subject to appropriate deed restrictions. It would limit the use to a cemetery or reverter clause if they were not to use it as such, but give them a chance to expand it again, subject to, you know, a fair market value valuation. So if y'all were okay with that, we would like to pursue that as part of the divestiture of this property. And Commissioner Scott had a chance to see that and hear about that when he was out there.
My comment, too, would be that where it's located, it won't have any effect on the marketability of the large piece. I think, and I do agree that that would be the neighborly and the proper thing for us to do.
Okay.
And I assume, Carter, that you're suggesting the sale be at some appraised value.
Yes, that would be my recommendation, just to make sure that we kept it consistent with how we would approach and other sales. And if for some reason there's some departure from that, we would come back and let you know.
Anybody have any issue with that? Okay. This item is also going to be heard in executive session, so we'll circle back later on it. Work session item 12, Sunset Advisory Commission recommended transfer of 8 historic sites, will also be heard in executive session. Work session item 13, litigation update on oyster litigation, CWD litigation, and border wall will be heard in executive session. So at this time, pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 of the Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive session will be held for the purpose of deliberation of real estate matters under 551.072 of the Act and seeking legal advice under 551.071 of the Act, including legal advice regarding pending or contemplated litigation. So we'll recess an executive session at 12:04 p.m. We'll now reconvene the work session on March 19, 2019 at 1:28 p.m. With respect to work session item 11, disposition of property, Jasper County, 219 acres of land and a permit for up to 811 acre-feet of water at the Jasper Fish Hatchery, I will authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process regarding the disposition of that property. With respect to work session item 12, Sunset Advisory Commission recommendations for transfer of certain properties owned by the Parks and Wildlife Department to the Historical Commission, no further action is required at this time. Work session item 13, litigation update, no further action is required at this time. So I declare that the commission has completed its work session business and adjourn us at 1:29 p.m. Thank you.